Exposing free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Thanksgiving, 2021. And in this year of our Lord, and it is actually 400 years after the first Thanksgiving feast. Last year was the 400th anniversary of them landing. But of course, there were no celebrations last year. But I am going to play for you some excerpts from the show last year when I talked about Thanksgiving and the origins of it. I talked about the different revolutions that happened about 13 years apart, 1776, 1789. 1789, the French Revolution, and we are still following, for the most part, that pattern. And that is a struggle that we have right now between those two revolutions. We're also going to have Matt Truella's interview from last week, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrate, and an interview of a lesser magistrate, who is very important, Sheriff Hathaway. We're going to have both of those. But before we do, I'm going to have a quick word about what is coming up in the first clip. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You know, last year I talked about the two different revolutions, 1776, 1789. I think that's still important, probably even more so this year, as we see the Marxists, who are in control of schools and the media, are pushing more than ever a different story of America's origins, the Project 1619. We're going to talk about why they're trying to substitute that for 1620, how they are lying to people about that. But before we do, I want to go back and play for you my comments from last year, Thanksgiving 2020.
It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. And whereas both houses of Congress have by their joint committee requested me to recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer, to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a form of government for their safety and happiness. Now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th of November, next, to be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being, who is the beneficent author of all good that was, that is, or that will be, that we may then all unite in rendering under Him our sincere and humble thanks for His kind care and protection of the people of this country, previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of His providence, which we experienced in the course and the conclusion of the late war, and for the great degree of tranquility, union, and plenty which we have since enjoyed, for the peaceful and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the nation one now lately instituted for the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed, and the means we have of acquiring and diffusing useful knowledge, and in general for all the great and various favors which He hath been pleased to confer upon us. Also, that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us all, whether in public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws, discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed, to protect and guide all sovereigns and nations, especially those that have shown kindness to us, and to bless them with good government, peace, and concord, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, and the increase of science among them and us, and to generally grant unto all mankind such a degree of temporal prosperity as he alone knows to be best. Given under my hand at the city of New York, the third day of October in the year of our Lord, 1789. George Washington. That was the first declaration for Thanksgiving. And of course, it was interestingly enough on the 26th day of November. Tomorrow is the 26th day of November. That, however, was back in 1789. I thought it was interesting that Washington began by saying it was the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Isn't it interesting? Because I don't know of any other country that does this. I don't know of any other country that sets up a national holiday to thank God for the blessings that he's given to that country. And as Washington said, you know, we want to acknowledge with grateful hearts what God has done in terms of blessing this country. Before the war, we had prosperity, even before that. And he said, and then he blessed us with mercies and with interpositions of providence that we experienced during the course and the conclusion of the recently concluded war. And then he said, we have been blessed to be able to establish a new, not just this government, but many governments throughout the country. And lately, this new national government that they had just created, that was 1789. That was as they were creating the Constitution. And so the first thing they wanted to do was to hold a day of thanksgiving and prayer. I thought it was interesting that they said that they would also pray for the protection and guidance of all sovereign nations, not just America. Yeah, I think we need to make sure that our government looks at the interests of America. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we were not at a state of continual war with others? It was Washington who said, we don't want to become like the Europeans. We don't want entangling foreign alliances. We don't want to have a perpetual state of war. And yet, that's what we do have. We had George W. Bush. Got a little bit of a late start, but, you know, they started the wars after 9/11. And then for, you know, nearly 8 years, he was at war with multiple nations. When Obama came in, he expanded the number of nations that we were at war with, and he was the first president to be at war for all 8 years of his term. Now, President Trump at war for his 4 years that he's here. And perhaps, you know, if he gets through the Supreme Court trial, he will do something to stop these wars. He's going to have to make sure that he's got personnel that are different from Mattis and H.R. McMaster, of course. These people that he put in place, you know, personnel or policy. And if you put in warmongering military-industrial complex shills and bureaucrats, don't expect to end any wars. That's why it was such a disappointment to see the people that he picked from the very beginning. Bankers who have stolen from our people, bankers that Thomas Jefferson warned. He said, you know, if we set up these central banks, we're going to wind up homeless on the continent our forefathers conquered. And that's turning out to be prophetically true. It wasn't that he was a prophet. He just understood human nature. He understood the nature of these institutions. But, you know, when we hear politicians talk about responsibility today, you got to ask them, to whom are you responsible? Are you responsible to God? Now, see, our politicians have allowed and supported the idea that God is to be banned out of the public square. That was never the case. That was something that was invented. You know, that whole idea of a separation of church and state was something that came out of a letter of assurance from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist. It had been spread around, a lot of lies by John Adams. They were sworn enemies at the time. They later reconciled to each other, died on the same day, 4th of July. They had been in severe competition with each other, told a lot of lies about each other as politicians. And one of the lies was that Jefferson was going to confiscate the Bibles. And so you had people burying Bibles in their backyards. And so the Danbury Baptist said, "Are you going to do anything like that?" And he said, no. There's a wall of separation. For Jefferson, that wall was a wall around government. But in the mid-20th century, they put that wall around churches. And now we have politicians who are not just censoring, but now they are banning worship services. They're banning singing, even if they allow worship services. We have underground churches that are meeting in America. They're not talking about as much as they do in the UK. That's where we are today. Do you think God is going to bless a country like that? Mr. President, the small progress that we've made after 4 or 5 weeks close attendance and continual reasonings with each other, our different sentiments on almost every question, several of the last producing as many no's as I's, is, methinks, a melancholy proof of the imperfection of the human understanding. We indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom, since we've been running about in search of it. We've gone back to ancient history for models of government and examined the different forms of those republics which have been formed with the seeds of their own dissolution and now no longer exist. We have viewed modern states all around Europe but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of lights to illuminate our understandings? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. Have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests, our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to the future age. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom, and leave it to chance, war, and to conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate in that service. Benjamin Franklin, Thursday, June 28, 1787, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Isn't that interesting? And of course, we do open our services now with prayer. In it, it's become kind of a perfunctory prayer. It wasn't the type of thing that when they were fighting Great Britain, the world's most powerful government at the time, a world empire. I can imagine that their prayers are pretty heartfelt and pretty fervent. They weren't the flowery speeches that typically open our services. Not all of them are that way. In many cases, however, we have had, because of the ACLU and others, we've now turned it into a mockery. You know, we have the Church of Satan open a prayer or something like that. But we have to understand the foundations of this country. And if we don't understand that liberty is a blessing from God, if we are going to heap scorn on God, if we are going to engage in religious persecution, this country has some very rough days ahead of it. And even those of us who are not a part of that will be suffering along with that. That's one of the reasons why God tells us to pray for the peace of the people that we live under, to pray for wise leaders. Let me just ask you, have you seen any wise leaders lately at any level of American government? Is that not a testimony of God's judgment? The fools and the clowns that are leading our country, is that not a testimony of God's judgment on us? The corruption, that's this dishonesty that we see happening now. As George Washington said in 1783, it is yet to be decided whether the revolution must ultimately be considered to be a blessing or a curse. A blessing or a cursed curse, not to the present age alone. For with our fate will the destiny of unborn millions be involved. Those words have never had a deeper meaning than when we look at the rolling out of a massive program to inject people with untested, untried, radical DNA modification vaccine, to incentivize it, to bribe people, to whip people into submission with unconstitutional house arrest, to purge us out of society like we were a leper colony if we don't take their dangerous drugs? Do you understand the technology that's involved here? Do you understand the curse that Washington has become, not only on Americans, but on the world? The center of this dark research, this biowarfare research, all these people talking about, well, was it, did this come out of a bioweapons lab? Well, if it didn't, there will be something coming out of that. You look at these people, Francis Collins and Fauci at the NIH. They're not only pushing DNA modification and transhumanism. Oh, yeah, they're pushing transhumanism very hard. They're pushing now the Human Connectome Project. All of Washington, you've got DARPA, you've got BARDA, you've got IARPA. These people are all involved in trying to read and manipulate minds, our minds, to try to manipulate our biology, to track us, to poison us. This government has become a curse on mankind. And may God shut it down. Alexis de Tocqueville said, we should not comfort ourselves on the supposition that barbarians are still far from us. For there are people who will allow the light to be snatched from their hands, and there are people who stifle it under their own feet. Is that not a description of our generation? Have we not become two groups of people, one of them actively stamping out the light with their feet? And the other group, those of us who are professing Christians, allow them to snatch it out of our hands? I'll read you another quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, because these are three quotes that open up a piece done by Oz Guinness. It's an update to his 2018 book, talking about the challenges, the two different revolutions that America faces. I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, and it's an excellent book. And I want to put some of these things, Thanksgiving, the Pilgrim's experience, and our experience as a nation into this context. And that is the real context. You had a couple of different revolutions, 1776 and 1789. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "The Western world has arrived at a decisive moment. Over the next few years, it will gamble the existence of the civilization that created it. And I think that it is not aware of that. Time has eroded your notion of liberty. You've kept the word, but you've devised a different notion of it, and you've forgotten the meaning of liberty." You know, I played for you the first declaration by George Washington right after they, you know, as they were putting together the Constitution. And so we need to have a day where we set aside, we thank God for all that he's done for us before the war, during the war, now after the war, being able to create a national government. Pray that he blesses us with wise leaders. And for many generations, we were blessed. Because, not because we had wise leaders, we were given wise leaders because we were a nation that honored God. That's why America was singularly blessed among all nations in the last couple of hundred years. I believe God has now removed that hand of blessing. You can see it all around us because we removed God. And so we need to go back and think about, you know, some of the history lessons that we can learn, based on the experience of the Pilgrims. You know, I pointed out, and I'll talk a little bit about this, a little bit more about this. I really liked, somebody sent me Oz Guinness's essay that he updated this year, based on a book that came out in 2018, talking about the difference between the two revolutions, 1776 in America and 1789 in France, separated by 13 years. But separated by many, many, many ideological issues there. And as Oz Guinness points out, the 1789 revolution, the Jacobin revolution, the French revolution, was the pattern for Marxist and socialist revolutions since then. America was kind of unique. And so he says, you know, in this essay, why has America gone down a different path? How has America been different than communist Russia, communist China, and others? And what is it that made us great in the first place? That's something we need to think about, because now these two ideas are clashing in America. He talked about that a couple of years ago. We've been talking about this for quite some time. But I thought it was interesting to put it in the context of two competing revolutions 13 years apart. And as I said a week or two ago when I talked about this, I said at the same time, you know, you look at America, we have two kind of foundational colonies. One of them was at Jamestown, and the other one was at Plymouth, the Mayflower. And they had very different orientations, those two colonies did. They were also 13 years apart, just like these two revolutions. And when you look at what happened with the Mayflower Compact, first of all, why did that happen? And why did the Pilgrims come to America? Well, it was for religious freedom, obviously. We know that. Do you realize how they were persecuted? Do you realize that they tried to escape to Holland? And even as they did that, many of them were arrested. Some of the women were, you know, the men were getting things on board, and the police showed up and arrested them for even trying to escape. They wanted to be able to worship freely. And, of course, you have many Christians later in the 1600s, you had John Bunyan, who spent, I don't know how many years he was in jail. The guy who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, he was in there for more than a dozen years, I believe, simply because he had a church that was not the government-established, government-approved church. And so these people wanted to have freedom. So they eventually got to Holland. They stayed there for about a dozen years. And even though Holland, interestingly enough, was very much like America is today, Holland was, do whatever you want. We've got a free country here. They were very prosperous. And yet, as the pilgrims were there, they noticed, this isn't really, there's something about this that just seems off because our children are being kind of seduced by this prosperity, this worldliness. We don't like what is happening in this society, even though they leave us alone. We don't like what's happening there. And so they decided that they would head to America. It was a difficult journey. It had a leaky ship. I've been to Plymouth with my family. It's amazing how small the Mayflower was. I mean, you get on that thing and you think about the fact they had two. I mean, they didn't have much space to start with, but they took, once the speedwell was leaking multiple times, they just said, all right, we'll leave this here. Put two ships worth of people and belongings on the Mayflower. And I know it was like 100 people or something on there. I remember we were there and thinking, 100 people? What'd they do, stand shoulder to shoulder the entire voyage here? And, of course, the ship nearly broke up. They had to use a printing press to keep the thing open. And when they finally got to America, they were headed to Virginia. And the storms, the heavy storms that they went through in the Atlantic, blew them off course all the way up to Massachusetts. When they realized they were in the wrong place, they tried to pull back out again. And over again, the storms pushed them in. And so finally they gave up and they said, well, this is perhaps where God wants us to be. And that was when they wrote the Mayflower Compact. They already had a charter that they were going to be governed under if they went to Virginia. So they came up with the Mayflower Compact. And we look at the Mayflower Compact, the language in it, says that they have done this, they've undertaken this for what purpose? Was it for money? Was it for prosperity? There's nothing wrong with money and prosperity. Those were the things that founded Jamestown. But Jamestown was basically a commercial venture. And eventually, that commercial venture bore some really evil fruit, slavery, in 1619. A year before these people came, for the glory of God, for the advancement of the Christian faith, to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia. But by these documents here, we solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic. That had never been done before. And except for America, pretty much hasn't been done since. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Stories of this event. And really, it is a story of the providence of God, is what happened to the Indian Tisquanto. Squanto, many people shorten it up. Where they landed, as amazing as this is, thinking about the fact that they were headed to Virginia, they got blown off course, they got repeatedly blown back to shore. They finally gave up and said, all right, let's create a document. They created the Mayflower Compact, as John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, said. By the way, I went to that high school named after this guy. Just a little aside. Described the agreement as the only instance in human history of a positive, original social compact. And believed to influence the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. And I do believe that it did. And so what they did was they declared why they were there, why they were setting up this colony. It was for the way that they wanted to live. They wanted to be able to be free to worship God, to honor God. That was their first priority. And God honored that. And he took them to a place that was outside the control of these people that had financed their journey. And they landed in a spot where the entire village had been wiped out by a virus. It wasn't COVID-19. It was like a real virus. It had been brought by Europeans, and it was a novel virus to the Indians, and it wiped out an entire village. And they found one person who was there. Now, why was Squanto there? He had been captured previously by an Englishman, taken as a slave, kidnapped, taken to Spain. He had Spanish monks had taught him many things. They taught him some farming capability that he didn't know. He knew things that he didn't know even as an Indian. And eventually, this monk found him an Englishman that he could work for. The Englishman liked him. The Englishman was a Christian as well. Taught him English, taught him many skills. Sent him to America as part of an expedition. And he was allowed because they liked him and he became a friend to them. They gave him his freedom and they allowed him to go back, but there was nobody left in his village. So when these pilgrims who just took off, not knowing anything about how to farm, when they landed, they found an Indian who walked up to them speaking English and an empty place where nobody was living. And he helped them as a liaison to the other Indian tribes that were around there. And they lived at peace for quite some time until King Philip's War. And there were some incidents back and forth where there's some friction between the different communities, as there always will be. There's bad people in both communities. But they basically worked it out until one leader came along, King Philip. And then they had an extended war. But that happened quite some time after that. And so when you look at this, it was a harsh life. A harsh life for both Squanto and for the pilgrims. Like I said, half of them died under those harsh circumstances. Squanto eventually died. But everybody, of course, dies eventually. But, he died of a virus. But it was part of God's providence in his life to introduce himself to Squanto and for Squanto to be there to help them. And that's the way we see things happening. And that's why we should not be afraid of this virus. We should not be afraid to live our lives. We should not be afraid to take risks. We should not be afraid to stand up for liberty, our liberty, our family's liberty.
Circumstances, hunger, hardship, and the storms of life, but they were never blown off course. They had a transcendent purpose for their life. And in their amazing story, we can see the providence of God who arranges the circumstances of our lives in ways that those who follow him can say, so from the beginning, the fight we were winning, because the Lord is on our side. All glory be thine. So I want to talk today about how things have changed in the last year in terms of the struggle for our origins and the struggle to define who we are. You know, Lewis Carroll, in his Alice in Wonderland book, he has Alice standing at a crossroads, and she says to the Cheshire Cat, which way should I go? And he says, well, it depends on where you're going. She says, I don't know. And he says, well, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. The problem is, the other people do know which road they want us to go on, and we better figure out the difference. We better get our bearings, and part of getting our bearings is not only understanding where they want to take us, but also understanding how we got to where we are and where we want to be. So I want to focus on that a little bit today. And as I said in the comments from last year that you just heard, I was talking about Oz Guinness and his contrasting of the American Revolution with the French Revolution, 13 years apart, 1776, 1789. He was writing some op-ed pieces about this in May of 2020. He was giving some presentations before things got really locked down. And some of the excerpts of what he had to say, he said, the U.S. is gradually switching from a worldview influenced by a biblical American Revolution model to an anti-religious French Revolution model, according to author and social critic Oz Guinness. Now, when we look at 1776, there was a good bit of drift there from where the Pilgrims had drifted there at Plymouth. So we're going to talk about the earlier attitudes that founded this country. But let's take a look first before we go all the way back to 400 years ago. And of course, last year was the 400th anniversary of their landing. This year is the 400th anniversary of them barely surviving. Just a few of them had survived that first year. And they did get together with the Indians, with the natives. And I'll call them Indians because that's what Russell Means says. He says, we got a lot of people who have been here for centuries because of Jamestown and because of Plymouth. And he said, they see themselves as Native Americans, so we're going to use the term Indians. That's why they set up the American Indian Movement. We're going to use the term Indian as a distinctive. So I'm not going to be politically correct. We all know who we're talking about. It's not somebody from India. So I'll be referring to them as Indians. So you look at 1776 versus 1789, as he put it, titled the speech, The Roots of the Present Crisis. He said, the American Revolution of 1776 and the English Revolution of 1642, which, again, just 22 years after they left, things were percolating up, religious tensions, political tensions. That's when you had the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell fighting the King Charles. I can't talk about Prince Charles. Yeah, this is the second Charles, the third Charles that they've had. They had a Charles I, a Charles II. Charles I lost his head, and Charles II was eventually restored to the throne. Don't know what's going to happen with this Prince Charles. But it was, as most situations were at the time, there was a connection between church and state that was very unhealthy for both, frankly, but especially for the church, for religion. But that particular revolution in 1642 had a lot of religious components to it. The Anglican Church was not tolerant of any other churches, and there was some aspects of intolerance with Cromwell, but not nearly as much as had been there with the Anglican Church at that time. But it helped to establish the power of Parliament over the king. Much of that was brought back, but there was a lot of involvement in the worldview of the people who fought this. They were very heavily connected to their religious viewpoints. As he points out, Oz Guinness says the French Revolution of 1789, however, was expressly anti-biblical and anti-Christian, anti-religious. And what we see happening today, the subsequent revolutions of the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, all these Marxist revolutions have followed in the pattern of that French Revolution, that socialism. And so today, these two streams of history are fighting each other in our country and around the world, but especially in America. The spirit of the French Revolution is what we see that is trying to purge everything in our history and trying to rewrite our history and trying to put us into a socialist state. And they're very hostile to religion, as you point out, certainly to the Christian faith. And it's been a characteristic of the French Revolution, Russian, Chinese, all these Marxist revolutions ever since. The current state of division in the U.S. ultimately stems from a difference between those who look at freedom from the perspective of 1776 and those who define freedom by the perspective of the French Revolution and its heirs. Ideological progression of the French Revolution, tying it to the rise of nationalism in the 19th century and revolutionary socialism in the 20th century. In the 21st century, this developed into cultural Marxism, or neo-Marxism, and into critical theory, which involved a long march through the institutions to enact social change, which is where we are today. That is what is happening to our political, but especially to our educational institutions. Ideas like political correctness, postmodernism, tribalism, sexual revolution, and things down currently to the rage for socialism. All these ideas go back to the heirs of the French Revolution, and they have nothing to do with the American Revolution and its biblical roots. And so I want to talk a little bit about the Christian roots of this country. And it's not just this country, because everything is, we're seeing the same agenda that's being run worldwide. As George Gilder pointed out, these technocrats who seek to set up a global governance are really neo-Marxists. They're really the heirs of the French Revolution. And they're very intolerant of their secular religion, their secular humanism, is very intolerant of any other religion, and they seek to purge that. So in 2021, if you see yourself as someone who does not want to be a part of this new world order, the problem is there isn't a new world to go to. But you can reorder your society. You cannot comply with what is happening. And we need to have a vision to build our society as we want it. That was one of the key things that I think we should take away from the pilgrims of 400 years ago. They had a clear vision of what they wanted. And as they separated themselves from these places that they had gone, as they had been persecuted and these people had attacked them, they had a very clear vision of what they wanted for themselves and especially for their family, for their children. And so we need to act on that in this socialist opposition that we have today. To give you an idea of the socialist opposition that we are facing, I want to play for you PBS's American Experience. Now, they did a story, nice production values, great photography, about 6 years ago about the pilgrims. And it was a very dishonest, as you could expect from PBS, a very dishonest history. I want to play for you the short trailer that they used to introduce that.
If you ask people, where does America start? They'll say, it starts in Plymouth Rock.
There's more to the story than the story we all know.
They were a very small group of very extreme people.
They weren't the people that you would expect to be founding a new colony. There's a sense that they came to America in search of religious freedom. They didn't.
The Pilgrims on American Experience.
Isn't that amazing? There is a sense that they came to America for religion. They didn't. They didn't come for that. Maybe these experts on history at PBS, maybe they got to go back and read some of the diaries as ample original sources. If they were real historians, they would do something like that. But no, they're going to come back with their revisionist history and tell you the untold story. Oh, everything that you know is wrong. So let me just wipe that slate clean. I've got a whole new, you know, history to give you right now. And, of course, since they are the authorities, they're the experts, they're the government, then everything that they have to say is true, of course. So that was about 6 years ago. They revived that about a year ago because it was going to be the 400th anniversary of the crossing. There was an interesting article. Chuck Norris has had enough of the revisionist history. So he took history.com to task. He said, look at what they're telling people. He said, the public schools won't teach about Thanksgiving, but you should. And I would just suggest to you what we did in our family. It's probably not available anymore, but we had a set that we used to teach the kids when they were little. It looked like a treasure chest and had this, icons of the pilgrims on it. And it had little cards and little tokens, you know, for the small kids. And the story was divided into seven different sections. And so we could tell a little bit of the story about the pilgrims one night, and then after that there'd be a question and answer period. And they had all the questions there. And it was a great way to teach history, you know, doing something like that and doing it deliberately. You need to do that, whether your kids are in school or not. You should get your kids out of school. I'll just say it. You got to get your kids out of these schools because they are trying to poison their minds and their bodies and their spirits. So we used to do that. And then at the very end of it, it would ask the kids to come up with things that they were thankful for. That's probably one of the best exercises. It's a great exercise for adults as well. You know, we're under a lot of pressure. We have a lot of concerns about the future. All of us do. And if you take the time to sit there and think about the good things that have happened, and especially as a Christian, to look at how bad things that have happened in your life that were difficult at the time, that you didn't like at the time, but you can look back as in perspective, and you can see how it was a good thing in your life, how you learned something from it, how you were made stronger by it. So that's an exercise that we all ought to do, especially this time of year. It's one of the things I like about Thanksgiving, is that it's a holiday set up to specifically to do that, rather than trying to, all these other things that have been added to it. I know that there's a lot of commercialization around Black Friday, but still, again, you can decide how you're going to celebrate the holiday. And it's probably, I think, in spite of Black Friday, it's one of the least commercialized of the holidays. But here's what Chuck Norris says. He said, you look at secularism, and it is, succinctly put, a movement to get rid of God or anything that is religious and to suppress that. And this has been growing religion. Secular humanism is a religion. It's a belief set. It's a worldview. They have a lot of prohibitions as well as a lot of demands, things that you must do, things that you cannot do. And now they've added all the COVID rituals to it. But he points out that history.com said on their website, they say the pilgrims actually had no reason to leave the Dutch Republic in order to go to America to seek religious toleration because they already had it, said a guy. So the same thing that you heard from the PBS trailer there, they said they already had it. Therefore, you have to look for other reasons as to why they might have risked the dangers of going across to the New World. And one of the big reasons was commercial. We'll talk about that in just a second. But then they also, in this same article from history.com that Chuck Norris is talking about, you can see his article at WND.com. He says, history.com concluded, like tens of millions of newcomers who would follow in their wake to America, the pilgrims were economic migrants. In other words, the pilgrims were no different than modern-day migrants from Mexico or Central America who were just seeking a better financial living. You see how that is the conclusion that they want to push. That is the political position they want to push. And so they go back and reinterpret what the pilgrims said, what they did, in light of the conclusion that they want. This type of childish rewriting of history is what we're seeing everywhere. That's why you have to, especially with your kids, you have to be deliberate in your opposition to it. You have to say, this is what they're teaching, this is why this is not real, and this is what is really happening. Most important thing to these people was their religious liberty. They went to jail. They had, as one of these cases, they got there while they were in the process of transferring their belongings to a ship, and the women got arrested. They eventually were able to get them back, but they were separated. In another case, they had the ship's captain turn them in as a traitor. When you look at what they said about eventually escaping to Holland, what this guy is saying, well, in the Dutch Republic, they had religious tolerance. And so they didn't come for that. That's the simple-minded way. But that's what somebody would say that doesn't actually read their diary, as Chuck Norris points out. He said William Bradford, who wrote an account of what they did, he was their leader. He became the governor in the colony that they established. And so he wrote a history. There were a couple of other people who wrote a history. He wrote a very comprehensive one, and he gave three reasons why they left the Netherlands in 1620 and decided that they could not go back to England because they would be arrested. That happened multiple times. So they decided, though, that they wanted to go to America. Here's the reasons that he gave. He said, number one, they believed that secular, liberal Dutch society was corrupting their children's faith and causing them to turn away from the church and from their English roots. Is that happening today in America? I think so. You know, as Christians, and we look at this, and again, the very fact that they're teaching the 1619 Project and revisionist history, the purpose of that and so many other things that they're teaching is to corrupt their children's faith, your children's faith. But it's far, far worse now what they're trying to do to the children when you look at the LGBT agenda. So they're eradicating your culture, your country, trying to establish a different baseline there. At the same time, they are coming after the kids sexually and spiritually. Number two, they were facing imminent dangers and more economic hardships because of the impending end of the peace treaty between the Netherlands and Spain, a religious war in which they could have been hunted down and killed by Catholic Inquisitioners of the Church of, as the Church of England did in their homeland. So whenever the church is allied, and that was the big problem at this time, every government had an official church, and if you didn't belong to that official church, they would use the power of the government to come after you. That's why this is such a key thing in America to establish religious liberty. And the third thing was that they yearned to transplant and grow their own separatist church in the New World through the evangelization of the natives. Now, we would never do that today, would we? Yeah, you know, because that would be, you know, cultural colonization. To push your culture, your religion on other people. No, they believed in the Christian religion. And so that was compassionate for them. They were trying to help these people. They're trying to save them, give them a better life now. And they really believed that. So he points out, he said, even the guy who wrote that they didn't leave for religious reasons because they had religious tolerance in a very secular, very wealthy society there in Holland, but it was corrupting their children. He said even that author, Simon Target, that they cited to support their idea that it was all about commercialism, it was all just about money, even he said the pilgrims also believed the New World gave them the opportunity to evangelize Native Americans and to undertake, as Bradford wrote, the propagandizing and advancing of the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world. And when you look at the document that they put together, we call it the Mayflower Compact, and actually they called it something very different. As a matter of fact, that's an interesting bit of trivia. It wasn't called the Mayflower Compact for 173 years. What did they call it? How did they see it? There's an interesting article from a Hillsdale College professor, Bradley Berzer. He says, Mayflower Compact or Plymouth Combination. He said, for the last 14 years I've been teaching at this school, I've had the joy of watching 40 freshmen respond to the complexities and the depths of a seemingly very simple document that we call the Mayflower Compact. And he points out how it's just really not much larger than a paragraph. And the key aspects of it, as I lay it out, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia. But of course, they weren't in Virginia, and they knew that. They'd been blown off course. They'd been blown up to Massachusetts, as a matter of fact. A lot of heavy storms, a lot of damage to the ship. It was a very difficult crossing. And then as they tried to head to where they were supposed to be, they kept repeatedly being pushed to shore. So it's like, well, all right, we're going to have to put in here. And so they decided that they would write up their own documents. The amazing thing is, after they wrote this up to the glory of God, when they got to shore, they found an Indian who walked up to them speaking perfect English. And that story, as I mentioned last year and I played at the beginning of the show, it's amazing, the providence of God. And you can look at that from a lot of different perspectives. You can look at all the people that died in that Indian village so that it was empty when they got there. That was God's providence. We don't understand what was involved in that. We don't judge that. But certainly from the standpoint of Squanto, it was a difficult situation for him. He had been captured as a slave, but then some good things had happened to him. He learned a lot of things about agriculture above and beyond what he had known before. And he also learned to speak English. God brings him back to that area, the heartbreak of finding everyone gone. But eventually, Squanto became a Christian himself. And so God works in very strange ways. But listen to what he has to say about what the real purpose of this document is. He says, as he goes over this document with his class every year, he said, my first thought after reading this every January for the past 14 years is what incredibly pugnacious audacity these pilgrims had. Ruling themselves with a simple agreement, a single paragraph, and a deep and abiding faith, a faith that I don't necessarily share, but one that I respect immensely. Who were these people, and what was their secret? He said, my second thought is, this could never have been composed by anyone but the most Protestant of Protestants. Indeed, even as a practicing Roman Catholic, I've had a hard time imagining the same scene being played out by French, Spanish, or Portuguese settlers. No, this is one of the great fruits of Protestantism. It's probably one that we Catholics should take to heart, especially as we continue to struggle over religious freedom and freedom of conscience in our fallen world in the 21st century. A cursory review of some of the excellent scholarship of the last 50 years reveals much about the document as well. Notably, in the introductory note to his masterfully edited work, Colonial Origins of the American Constitution, Donald Lutz cautions the use of the term compact with a 1620 document. He said the same is true for compact. He said the term is not used in any of the titles of these colonial documents, at least not by those who wrote them. Indeed, the Mayflower Compact was not named that until 1793. And was referred to by the inhabitants of the colony as the Plymouth Combination, sometimes simply as the Combination. The scholars of some merit renamed the document in the 1790s in a period of deep religious skepticism, giving it much more of a Lockean and secular title 173 years after its creation. He says that's very telling. What if we simply decided to rename, say, the Declaration of Independence, the Assertion of National Sovereignty, or the Up Yours, King George? He said neither of those would be totally inaccurate, but each would certainly be a bit bizarre, and each would have some fashion change our very perception and memory of the thing itself. Basically, that's what's being done with things like the New York Times 1619 Project. They're imposing their views backwards in time, the same as if we were to rename the Declaration of Independence, but it has far more deep-reaching consequences. And the reason they call it the Combination, if you look at the actual document, what they say after the introduction there, they say, by these documents here, we solemnly and mutually, in the presence of God and of one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic. And so that's what they mean by the Combination. They have combined. That's something that we don't typically use in that way. You know, you can combine chemicals to make a compound, but typically we talk about different combinations. Usually numbers come to mind, but that's not what they were thinking of. They were thinking about a unity. And it was really out of that unity that they started having common property. And that's where we have the narrative, in many cases, that this is really about learning the lesson of capitalism and private property. And they did talk about that, but it took them a couple of years to get to that point. But again, that was not the purpose of the pilgrims, and that's not the key issue to take away from that. As he points out here in this article, he said, while we could interpret the combination from a Lockean or a Hobbesian perspective, it would be absurd to do so. Hobbes was still 31 years away from writing his book, Leviathan. Locke was, it was 12 years before he was born in 1620. So he said, America is not Lockean. If anything, the influence went the other way, toward Locke, from America. Importantly, the authors of the combination never assert the existence of a state of nature. Instead, they recognize that they're beholden to scripture, to tradition, to hierarchical authority, and to English common law. Yet they were not prepared either to destroy these ties or to leave them out completely. Instead, they looked upon what they considered to be a virgin land and a promised land of sorts, and here they could take the best of the past, but they could implement it as they so desired. And that's the key thing. When we look, the key lesson for this is we need to take the best of the past and combine it to make a better future. And if we don't design our future, it's going to be designed for us. Very important for us to take a look at this, but to recover the things that, again, are the bedrock of our society, and that is to go back to a foundation that is eternal, that is spiritual. But the New York Times has been on a roll. It's not just a 1619 project. I'll give you an idea of their newest one. The Thanksgiving myth gets a deeper look this year. But, of course, they've attacked Thanksgiving and the founding of America. A couple of years ago, they had everything you learned about Thanksgiving is wrong. Everybody got it wrong, except non-historians who are journalists like this lady. They now have determined what the real history is, and they're going to rewrite it and tell you what that is. I guess it's just a rhetorical question as to why the New York Times hates America so much. Well, actually, it isn't. You understand, as I began, that this is really a clash of worldviews, a clash of cultures, and this really is a socialist revolution that has to destroy what is in place so they can establish their power. And what they have to destroy is the religious foundation of this country. So to destroy that, they have to destroy the history of the pilgrims. They call, as a matter of fact, defending Project 1619 in this most recent article. They said, imagine calling the 1619 Project debunked in order to defend a childish Thanksgiving myth. Yes, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Myths. If you remember The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell, and what he looked at was essentially stories and how they can shape people's lives and shape society. So we need to have something to put our lives into context. And so we're not talking about a myth in the sense that it's fictional, although both the 1619 Project and our understanding of history, what Bradford and others said, those things cannot be true at the same time. So when we look at this, C.S. Lewis also talked about myth. He said, the story of Christ is the greatest myth of all time. No, he didn't mean that it was a false story. He meant it was an epic story. And he said, the difference is that these other myths that are out there, those are men's stories. This is God's story. We have to have, as a society, and that's what this battle is about, an understanding of our position in life. giving a purpose to our society, a purpose to our life, and to understand where we fit in life. That was the thing that the pilgrims had, and that's going to be the thing that's going to sustain us through these strange and difficult times that we are in now, and that I think are going to get more difficult in this next year. That is, we have to have a foundation. We have to have a rock that is underneath us. And as we go back and look at this through life, that foundation for our society and for many other people has been Christ. And this is not just about getting through this life. This life is a very, very short period of time. And the pilgrims understood that. And so we need to be looking at the longer view. We need to understand what our context is. And I just want to say, as this has been a difficult year for many people, it's been a difficult year for us, but all of you who have supported us, who have spread the program, you have made a difference in our lives that you could never understand. And there's no way that I can tell you how much I and my family have appreciated your support this last year. We see this as coming from God, but we give thanks to you too, because we know that it comes from you as well. And it comes from your heart. Many of you have written very kind words to us. You have supported us through this. You've helped us to grow this program. And it is very important that we win this fight for hearts and minds and for souls. We have to understand where we're going. We have to understand where we have come from. And we have to understand that the battle is fought there, but it's also fought in prayers. And so we really do appreciate, and we can tell that many people have been praying for us who may not be able to support us because they're in difficult economic times. And so, as I say, as you heard me regularly say on these ads that we have telling people where they can find the show, we really want you to pray for our country as well. I pray that God would turn hearts one at a time. We don't want to impose some kind of a system on people, but God can change things, and we need to pray that He is going to bring a revival so that we return to the kinds of people who have a backbone to stand up against this tyranny. So stay with us, and we're going to talk about the lesser magistrate taking care of things locally, interviews with both Matt Cruella and with Sheriff David Hathaway. Thank you for listening, and we hope you have a happy Thanksgiving. God.
No government, no matter how well-intentioned, can replace the nurturing love of a parent. Yet in the United States, judicial activism and a pending UN treaty are poised to tear apart this most fundamental bond of society. These foreign and domestic threats would undermine the parental role and overrule parental wishes. All parents would have the legal status of an abusive parent, with the state and not the parents deciding what is in the best interest of the child. The relentless encroachment of judges and UN treaties that assume that government, not parents, has the best interest of the child at heart, will be stopped by nothing short of a constitutional amendment explicitly stating the rights of parents. Decisions affecting the child should be made by those who know and love that child, not by a distant bureaucracy. You can help protect children by helping those who care the most for them and those who care the best for them, the family. Find out what you can do at parentalrights.org.
The fourth turning is due to begin shortly after the new millennium, midway through the 00 decade. About the year 2005, a sudden spark will catalyze a crisis mood. Remnants of the old social order will disintegrate. Political and economic trust will implode. Real hardship will beset the land with severe distress that could involve questions of class, race, nation, and empire. The very survival of the nation will feel at stake. Sometime before the year 2025, America will pass through a great gate in history, commensurate with the American Revolution, Civil War, and twin emergencies of the Great Depression and World War II. The basis of this prediction is a cyclical view of history that Strauss and Howe discovered by going back through American and English history back to the mid-1400s. And they discovered that just as we have seasons of weather, we have seasons of society. And just as we don't know the exact date that winter is going to come, or whether it's going to be a harsh or a mild winter, we do know that it's going to follow fall, and we do know the approximate time that it's going to come.
We take a close look at the rhythms of American history, and in our book we make the following big prediction, that beginning about 10 years from now, America is due to enter an era of crisis, an era of political and social upheaval that will last around 20 years or so until the late 2020s. We call this era a fourth turning, and we think it's going to be a big threshold for the history of our nation. It's going to be something on par with World War II and the Great Depression, or going back the length of a human lifespan before then, the Civil War, or going back the length of another human lifespan, the American Revolution. It could be a time of tragedy or a time of great opportunity.
What they found was that societies will go through four phases of high, awakening, unraveling, and crisis. Humans go through four phases of life: childhood, young adult, midlife, and elderhood. And they noticed generations where people have shared experiences and attitudes are spaced about 20 years apart. And generations are shaped by where their childhood falls within the phases of society. Now, this got my attention because I noticed that there was a repeating pattern of about 72 years between significant dates in American history as well as some other histories. For example, if you go from the time the U.S. Constitution was written in 1789 to the beginning of the Civil War, 1861, that's 72 years. Another 72 years takes us to 1933, the beginning of the New Deal, another major transformation of American society. If you go another 72 years, that took us to about 2005, exactly where Strauss and Howe had predicted a major crisis and change would occur. And in addition, if you look at the Russian Revolution, from 1917 to 1989 was about 72 years. So it seemed to fit with the life cycle of humans. In a cycle, four generations, 20 years apart, are shaped by when their childhood falls within that cycle. And the names they use in their book, The Fourth Turning, come from the biblical account of Exodus. For example, you have one generation as a prophet generation. Now think of Moses calling a generation to change. The next generation, the nomad generation, wandering in the wilderness, a period of crisis and restlessness. The following generation would be a hero generation. Think of the Joshua generation taking a promised land. That often involves a major war. And then finally, an artist generation, the generation that builds a new society. Well, where does Strauss and Howe think that we are in this cycle? The researchers see the millennial generation, those born between 1982 to 2004, as the hero generation. And they see our society entering a fourth turning, a crisis period where society will be fundamentally transformed as it was with the American Revolution, the Civil War, or the New Deal. And the last time we faced a fourth turning was the Great Depression and World War II. Strauss and Howe's predictions of 22 years ago now look prescient. And we can see the storm surge coming in our society at our time, just as if a hurricane was approaching the shore. Now, our government has been undermining the foundations of liberty for a long time. And the question is, will you be a sandbag to help hold up and protect liberty, or will you stand by as it gets swept away and we enter a new dark age of authoritarianism?
All right, and joining us now is Dr. I keep calling you a doctor. I've had so many doctors on. I'm sorry, Sheriff David Hathaway, and I've talked to Sheriff Hathaway several times in the past. He is in a very interesting situation. He's right at a border town, and he has had one interview after the other about the open borders. But he's got a very different take on it. I mean, he's talking about what it is the lockdown has done to our economy and what the lockdown has done to the economy there at the border, because they did have a very thriving economic back and forth, just people coming back and forth trading. That type of thing has been shut down, while illegal immigration has really gone through the roof. But I've talked to David about many things, about economics as well. I found out about him through Lou Rockwell. He's had some interesting op-ed pieces there about economics. So he's not your usual sheriff. He's got a very broad background. Thank you for joining us, Sheriff Hathaway.
Yeah. Thank you very much, David, for having me on. And if I could say hi to some of my grandchildren that are listening in Florida, Lucas, Dorrit, and Becca, hi to you guys. A couple of grandchildren in Illinois, hi to Adam and Fiona. So get that out of the way, because I know they're tuned in. Thank you so much, David.
That's great.
Yeah.
Great. Glad to have them on there. When I talk to you, you know, you understand really what is happening with this. And this is the ongoing unending state of emergency that we're seeing everywhere. And you pointed out to me that you've got some people in Arizona that are trying to do something about that. And they've got a Republican governor there in Arizona who doesn't want to give up the reins of this power, just like we've seen a Republican governor in Idaho, Governor Brad Little. He shut down when the Republican legislature there said we're going to have a special session and stop this unending state of emergency. And that was in the summer of 2020. He said, no, you're not. And he shut them down. So what is the situation in Arizona? Is there a Republican legislature there? Or is it just a Republican governor?
Republican dominated legislature and a Republican governor. And, you know, there's kind of three things we can hit on. Time's not infinite, but this hypocrite Republican governor who speaks out of both sides of his mouth, he goes around, you know, touting the vaccines and how they're safe and effective and everybody should get vaccinated. But then he tries to play the other side, like where I'm opposed to vaccine mandates. And, you know, I think he's one of these ones that's probably planning on running for president in 2024. So, you know, he's trying to play all sides of the thing. But, you know, he's actually signed off on a bill that says that he opposes mask mandates and vaccine mandates. But one of the creepiest things he's done, his latest executive order, if you go to the governor of Arizona executive orders, is a thing called the Enhanced Surveillance Advisory. And you know, David, how usually they'll make these laws or edicts into euphemisms. They'll call them like the Puppy Dog and Rainbows Act, or, you know, the Patriot yeah. Act, something that's less mm-hmm. than what it really is. But surprisingly, he put the creepy title on this thing, on his latest executive order, that's exactly what it is. It's called the Enhanced Surveillance Advisory. And it's funny, like when you take that federal money, he declared you could do the same countdown that you do every day, David, you know, 600 and some days. You could do that on this governor, too. Arizona yeah. held hostage because he did his COVID state of emergency last March under the Trump administration. He's continued it all the way to the present day. There's groups fighting back to try to get him to undo that. So why did he do that? Why did he do his state emergency declaration for COVID? Well, it's very simple. It's money. In order to get that CARES Act money, the American Rescue Plan money, all this COVID-related money, he had to have a parallel emergency declaration that matched the federal emergency declaration. If he did like Kristi Noem did in South Dakota and didn't declare a COVID emergency, then, you know, he wouldn't be receiving those funds. You know, typically a governor can declare emergency for like a hurricane, you know, a volcano, an earthquake, a flood, you know, something, and then make his state eligible for low interest federal loans, or if there's some parallel federal money. But the strings attached on this are very simple. He has to share all the vaccine information, individualized data, with no ability to opt out for anybody who gets the shot in Arizona. And I'm going to read you some portions out of his latest executive order. Pursuant to the Enhanced Surveillance Advisory, Arizona Department of Health Services shall collaborate with the following: the CDC and the HHS, these are federal entities, Health and Human Services, by sharing the state's COVID-19 immunization and vaccine administration information with the CDC and HHS pursuant to and accordance with its data use and sharing agreement. So he signed an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, that by receiving this federal COVID money, he has to share back all this individual information for anybody who gets the vaccine with no ability to opt out, and I'll get to that here. It has to be shared through the Immunization Gateway Project, which is run by a private company, private contractor called Health Current, that is the gateway to send the information to the feds. But check this out. This is what they have to share. This is right out of the governor's order. This isn't some conspiracy theory website. This is a Republican governor. This is his words, with his signature. Pursuant to the Enhanced Surveillance Advisory, an individual, healthcare provider, or local health agency who administers COVID-19 vaccine shall report the following through a department required format to Arizona Department of Health Services every 24 hours. So this information must be reported every 24 hours to Arizona Department of Health Services, who then shares it all to CDC and HHS through the Immunization Gateway Project. So here's the things they must share. Once again, the following information must be shared every 24 hours by an individual, a healthcare provider, or a local health agency who administers COVID-19 vaccine. So anyone who administers a vaccine must share this according to this governor's executive order. A, the individual's name, comma, date of birth, comma, gender, comma, race slash ethnicity, comma, residential address, comma, phone number, and vaccine priority group. B, the vaccine product information, lot number, and expiration date. C, the route of administration and administration site on the patient's body. And D, the month, day, and year of each immunization. Now, people like me, we talk all the time about HIPAA and ADA, the American with Disabilities Act, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, that both have privacy provisions, confidentiality provisions, where patients don't have to share their information. They don't have to tell anybody about their medical decisions of whether they've been vaccinated or not. So Ducey is clever enough to put in here that you can't opt out. Let me read you this. Pursuant to the enhanced surveillance advisory status, Arizona Department of Health Service shall collaborate with healthcare providers and health plans to make all COVID-19 related data, included but not limited to COVID-19 immunization and vaccine administration, accessible through the statewide health information exchange for any purpose permitted by the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. So he uses the HIPAA language in there. So you think that he's complying with HIPAA. But right after that, it says, such information sharing may be permitted regardless of whether any individuals have opted out of having their individually identifiable health information accessible through the health information system pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 36-3803. Now, that statute is a medical privacy statute. I have that here in front of me, too. So it says, even if you've opted out using the state medical privacy statute, the information must still be shared.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read you that statute. Title 36-3803, Arizona Revised Statutes. The title of that statute is Individual Right to Opt Out of Health Information Organizations. And it says, an individual has the right to opt out of having the individual's individually identifiable health information accessible through a health information organization by providing notice as explained in the health information organization's notice of health information practices. So anybody can opt out under state law, and HIPAA also protects that right. But once again, back to Ducey's latest executive order, requiring that all of this be shared every 24 hours with CDC and HHS, such information sharing may be permitted regardless of whether any individuals have opted out of having their individually identifiable health information accessible through the health information organization pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 36-3803, which is the privacy statute. And what I'm reading right here, you can see there's the, I just read that highlighted part. Mm-hmm. There's the governor's signature. Yeah. There's his seal. This is his latest executive order saying that you cannot opt out of that. Now, that is the string attached to the federal money that goes along with his emergency declaration. You know, Christians talk about taking the mark of the beast, and some people say, oh, no, you know, you're wacko. How would they ever do that? How would they ever get everybody's information? You know how it says in the Bible, you won't be able to, you know, sell or trade or buy, sell, trade, you know, unless you take the mark of the beast. People think, well, you know, with this talk of going to a digital currency, how would they be able to track everybody's social credit or what you've done, if you've done what the government has told you to do, if you've gone against your belief, and if you've injected yourself with these aborted fetal cells, these vaccines that are made or tested using aborted fetal cells? You know, if you go against your beliefs and you compromise your Christian principles to do these things, they think, well, you know, how would this mark of the beast work? How would they get the information? Here's a Republican governor, a hypocrite, requiring that every 24 hours, all this personally identifiable information with no ability to opt out be shared with CDC and HHS. And if even specifically puts the language in there saying that nobody can opt out. And remember the information we're talking about. We're talking about your name, date of birth, your residential address, and your phone number, amongst other things, must be shared every 24 hours with the CDC. So, you know, before I get too long-winded here, there is pushback against this, and I'd like to get into that, of people talking about the same things you, David, about why is this emergency declaration still ongoing from this Republican governor that pretends like he's against all this vaccine mandates and all this nonsense coming out of Washington. But I'd like to get into some of that if you have time.
Let me interject here and say, you know, when the CDC put together stuff and the front part of it was loaded in there with instructions to all these top-notch healthcare people who are going to be working at Walgreens that were going to be injecting everybody, right? They're going to be sent this stuff at super subarctic temperatures. They've got to thaw it out, use it within a certain period of time. You've got to dilute it in a certain way, you know, and so forth. And I looked at that and thought, well, what could possibly go wrong with this? But at the back end of that order, and they put it out in August of 2020, talking about how they're going to grab all this information, report it to the CDC. Now it looks like they're reporting it also to HHS, and they're taking people's ability to opt out away from them as well. That's a key thing there. But the other thing I saw there, Sheriff Hathaway, was the fact that they were saying what really raised flags. They explained that away initially, saying, well, you know, we got to give you a reminder in 30 days because we don't want you to miss that second shot in 30 days, and we want to make sure that you get the same brand of vaccine because we really don't want to mix these things. Now they're telling everybody, you take one of these, one of those, it doesn't matter, right? So that's all gone by the wayside. But the thing that really stuck out to me back in August of 2020 was the fact that they had another field down there that said refused. So it was like they were telling the health providers, I want to get all this information on everybody, and it's not just so that I can call them in 20 and 30 days to get a re-up of number two, but I want to know who refused as well. So this thing has stunk from the very beginning, but you're right. It's all about the money, and these people have simply sold us out and sold out the rule of law in this country for money.
Yeah, exactly, and Just to let you know, there are some brave people standing up to this stuff in Arizona. I myself, this surprised me. This started a few months ago. I started getting hundreds of affidavits and letters from people all over the state of Arizona. They were addressed to the governor and to all 15 sheriffs in Arizona. There's 15 counties in Arizona. Every sheriff was getting hundreds of letters, and we wondered, what's the source of this? They're from a bunch of individuals, signed, notarized, and I've got one of them here. If you're not listening on a podcast, you can see these things that I've been getting. Uh-huh. I think I've gotten about 1,000 of these. I know it's in the hundreds. I don't know exactly how many, but this is an organization this is one of the good things, you know, the silver lining of the cloud of what's happened the last year and a half. People are starting to get together and talk personally and just stop being keyboard warriors and just blowing a lot of hot air. They're actually getting together saying, what's going on? What are we going to do? So
good.
People have now sent these affidavits to the governor of Arizona. And you talk about the lesser magistrates, like you mentioned on the podcast yesterday. Mm-hmm. They sent it to the governor, to the sheriffs, knowing that if the governor is not going to undo this unconstitutional and illegal declaration of emergency that he's done, then who's going to do something about it? But let me just read some of this in here. And just to show the blatant illegality of what the governor has done, not just that we don't like it, you and me, David, but it's blatantly illegal.
That's right.
It's different in different states. In some states, the governor has the ability to act for 24 days or 28 days before the legislature acts. You know, he can act on a state of emergency. Here, it's 24 hours. And let me read you the pertinent parts. Mm. This is out of this affidavit that I've gotten hundreds of these from individuals. This is addressed to the governor and copies mailed to all the sheriffs by certified mail. You cannot create new power or authority through executive order. You cannot govern by decree without limitation. In this respect, you also failed Arizona Constitution Article 5, Section 4, and Arizona Revised Statutes Title 26, Section 303, that states, this is the part in the statute about the governor's ability to act on a state of emergency. It says, the powers granted the governor, this is in the statute, by this chapter with respect to a state of emergency or a state of war shall terminate if the legislature is not in session and the governor within 24 hours after the beginning of such state of emergency has not issued a call for immediate special session of the legislature for the purpose of legislating on subjects relating to such state of emergency. So, you know, there's a saying attributed to, I think it's John Adams, you know, we are a government of laws, not a government of men. Mm-hmm. So if a governor tries to bypass the legislative functions, you know, of Congress or a state legislature and just govern by decree, govern by fiat, this prevents that from happening. And I'm going to read this again. It's so important that he is supposed to convene a special session of the legislature within 24 hours so that they can make decisions. They can govern. They can decide. So he has 24 hours to act. So I'm going to read again. This is right out of the statute, the Arizona statute. The powers granted the governor by this chapter with respect to a state of emergency or a state of war shall terminate if the legislature is not in session and the governor within 24 hours after the beginning of such state of emergency has not issued a call for immediate special session of the legislature for the purpose of legislating on subjects relating to such state of emergency. So he can bring up the topic. I think this is a state of emergency. He has 24 hours, and then after that, the legislature can decide if it's a legitimate state of emergency, and they take all action, and then he carries out the laws that they pass.
And yet here we are well over 600 days that this has been going, not 24 hours, but over 600 days. And there's a lot of states that have that type of thing in them, and then there's other legislatures that tried to get together and to put something like that in there to stop it if they didn't have that. And this has been shut down over and over again by these governors, many of them Republicans, simply because they've got the money and they've got the power, unlimited, both of those.
Yeah. And if we have time later on, I could get to another thing about how this money is being used in my community to hire people to knock on doors and see if people have been vaccinated. But if I could continue a little bit on this affidavit, it says, we the people, not having the power to make new laws or mandates, a prudent and logical approach would have been to call the legislature into special session to make decisions as a legislative body, which you failed to do. Not only is it prudent, it's required by statute.
Yeah.
And it says, we the people demand as our rights as the citizens of Arizona that the, quote, state of emergency, close quote, declared on March 11th, 2020, be immediately rescinded pursuant to Arizona Constitution Article 2, Section 8, right to privacy. No person shall be disturbed in his private affairs, and the state of emergency has violated Arizona residents on many fronts, from business shutdowns with financial loss to detrimental health and loss of life from postponed health care and isolated seniors in lockdown to a year of school missed by children across the state. And your continued effort to track and obtain personal information from all residents of Arizona is in direct violation of HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, as further stated in Miranda versus Arizona, quote, where rights secured by the Constitution are violated, there can be no rule making a legislation which would abrogate them, close quote. So this is, mailed to all 15 sheriffs in Arizona and to the governor. And as a matter of fact, we had an online conference between all the sheriffs, and one of them brought up like, hey, are you guys getting these affidavits? Where are these coming from? And I had researched it, and I had talked to the lady running this Arizona Stands Up organization is called Julie Wentz. And she would actually make an excellent guest for you to talk to.
Yeah.
She's a former healthcare worker that has just seen the injustice of this, never thought she would be a freedom crusader. And just this made her take a 180-degree turn in her life, and she's actually getting people together, telling them the importance. People don't know what we're talking about, David, that there's a state of emergency in Arizona that was declared for monetary purposes, and one of the strings attached is that everybody's information must be shared with the CDC and HHS. And it's right there on the governor's website, list of executive orders. You can read that executive order. So,
well, you know, there's a lot of people, Sheriff Hathaway, who are looking at this. People like Scott Gottlieb, who used to be the FDA commissioner. Now he's at Pfizer, and he's gone on, Sunday talk show saying, we better pull this back because people are waking up about this kind of stuff. And you've got other people in Europe who are saying the same thing. They have gone so far. You've got a certain segment of these people. The really dangerous ones, I think, are the ones who say, well, it's out there, and they do it subtly, but they don't really get into the mandate aspect of it. I mean, Biden is dangerous because if we don't, and this whole approach to mandate everything and to force it down our throats, that is very dangerous if we don't stand up to it. But the benefit of that is that it's going to wake people up, just like you pointed out with Julie Wentz, to wake up and to start paying attention and to see where this is all heading. And I think we're seeing a lot of that happening, and we're seeing this happening around the world. A lot of people are waking up. We don't need to have 100% of the people wake up. We need to have an activist group of about 10%. And I think we've got that and more of people who understand what's going on now. So that it's going to be a very dangerous time of opportunity for us, I think, is really where we are. It's a real crisis, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you talk to Julie Wentz, David, you'll find out that she's a very sincere, devout Christian, too. She's not just the freedom advocate. Every other thing is going to be quoting a Bible verse to you. She's a very principled Christian, and this is based on her Christian faith, the things that she is doing of trying to oppose this, of requiring everybody to take these, cannibalistic, these injections that have the aborted fetal cells used in the production and the testing. And just kind of talking quick here, because I got so much stuff we won't get to, but I would like to eventually get to these security bulletins. I'm holding this up to the camera if people are watching this on video. About, I get these bulletins from the chiefs of police and the sheriffs in the U.S. get what's called National Terrorism Advisory System bulletins. It comes from the Department of Homeland Security. But before I get to that, since we're talking about people knocking on doors and what this money results, Ducey takes all this money in so he can buy votes. So a lot of it comes in under the America Rescue Plan, and what that is supposed to be used for, this is from the Treasury website. Treasury Rescue Plan will deliver billions of dollars for eligible state, local, territorial, and tribal governments to respond to the COVID-19 emergency and bring back jobs. So how does this money get used in the local community, this America Rescue Plan money? And of course, everybody creates new positions and hires the employees because they don't have to raise property taxes. It's money from the Fed. So like, hey, yeah, you can hire somebody in the community, give out more jobs, buy political points for the community. But here's one that just came out in my county. Just an example. It says grant-funded position, three positions available, community health workers. So this is funded from federal grants, America Rescue Plan, that's given to the counties. And this community health worker, okay, what do they do? What are their duties and responsibilities? This is a job announcement that just came out in my county. Enters program-specific data into appropriate databases, comma, client records, comma, and program forms. So what's the data they're entering into the database? The same things we're talking about in the governor's executive order. Mm-hmm. What are some of their other duties? Performs home visits to identify clients. What do they mean by a client? Somebody where, we'll call you a client, a euphemism. You need to get the shot. Have you gotten the shot? Did you get your second dose? Performs home visits to identify clients and provide program-specific outreach services. Provides outreach services, information, and education to targeted populations. So who's the targeted population? Well, you got Governor Ducey's database that shows everybody who's gotten a shot, so you can go at all the addresses where they haven't gotten a shot and knock on the door and tell them the importance of getting the shot, because my position is funded by COVID money through the American Rescue Plan.
Wow.
It says provides outreach services through community presentations, distribution of flyers, support group meetings, and word of mouth promotion. What are the skills required? Well, you only need a GED or a high school diploma, but what are the skills required? You need to have this skill, persuading and influencing. That's listed right here. Skills required.
These are door-to-door salesmen. I mean, yeah. We used to have door-to-door salesmen for Bibles and encyclopedias, but now we got them for the pharmaceutical industry paid for.
Yeah, it's like an ends meet, like a pyramid scheme. Yeah, it's like a pyramid scheme where you'd get those ads in like these little local things or on Craigslist. You know, are you satisfied? Can you make ends meet on $5,000 a week? You know, are you good at persuading and influencing? So it says persuading and influencing is one of the skills. Another one is creative writing. Creative writing is another one of the skills. Like, to me, that means fiction, you know, creative writing and persuading and influencing. But I didn't want to spend too much time on that. That's just a manifestation of how Ducey's money that he's getting because of his declaration of emergency, how it's used to create this group of door knockers in my community to harass people. And that would never fly as a local tax-funded program. You could never say, our county board of supervisors in this county could never say, we're going to raise taxes to hire people to go knock on your doors and harass you. But if it comes from federal money, then nobody's opposed to it. But
that's right. Yeah, and we've had in the ad council that does all these federal advertising campaigns, things like Smokey the Bear and, you know, Only You Can Prevent Forest Fires. They've never had more money than they did with this. They got $250 million for the ad council. This is why you're seeing a lot of ads, but they're also using it to shower money on influencers on social media. They're giving it to YouTube and to Google to push this type of stuff. So, I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it, Sheriff Hathaway, how pervasive this propaganda and this advertising has been for a product for which they have absolutely no liability or oversight. We paid as taxpayers for this product to be developed. We paid to have it sent out, and we're now paying for them to advertise it. And they have no responsibility for the harm that they do to anybody. It's amazing.
No responsibility. And the media outlets are totally controlled. As you pointed out, 70%, I think 70% of Fox News funding comes from the pharmaceutical industry. I think 45% of the FDA's funding comes from the pharmaceutical industry. If you have time, there's lots of things I could get to. I'm holding up to the screen for the people that are watching on video. A lot of people do this on podcasts. This is the seal of Department of Homeland Security. This is something that all the sheriffs and chiefs of police get in the United States. It's called the
National. You sent that to me, and I really wanted to talk about it, but I knew you were coming on, so I thought we'd wait and talk about it. This is really amazing. Yeah. People, pay attention to this, and look at what their BOLO is. You know, be on the lookout for what? What are they looking out for, Sheriff?
Sheriffs get this, and I've been the sheriff since the beginning of this year, since January, and I've been sickened by these. And there was initially a lot of reference to January 6th in online forums and social media and grant programs to identify people. And there's this thing that they say, radicalization to violence. They always say that, like, we need to identify this kind of speech and then intervene before it turns into violence. It's amazing, but let me just read you some out of this National Terrorism Advisory Bulletin that sheriffs get. Today, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas issued a National Terrorism Advisory Bulletin regarding the current heightened threat environment across the United States. Heightened threat environment. You know, what is there, an alien invasion? What are there, incoming Russian Soviet missiles with, you know, ICBMs with nuclear warheads on them? What is this heightened threat environment? Remember, this is this is domestic. This is not talking about a foreign threat. What is this heightened threat environment? And it's all about domestic. This National Terrorism Advisory Bulletin is only about domestic. That's all it's about. And this is what I get. So this is the heightened threat environment. It says, the United States continues to face a diverse and challenging threat environment as we approach several religious holidays and associated mass gatherings. The heightened threat environment is related to the fact that we are approaching several religious holidays and associated with mass gatherings that in the past have served as potential targets for acts of violence. So, you know, heaven forbid that you get together for Thanksgiving, you know, with your family, you know, and that you have
usually a terrorist event happens around that time, right?
Right.
Somebody exploding turkeys or something. I don't know.
Yeah, these bowl games, you know, where big football games and things like that, you know, or, you know, people get together for New Year's, you know, Thanksgiving and whatnot, that is being described. Basically, the nuclear family and anything that private society does is the big threat. And this thing gets worse when they say the things you need to be looking out for. But they love these little acronyms. They say, through the remainder of 2021 and into 2022, domestic violent extremist, DVEs. You ever notice they give an acronym or initials to something that's really heinous? The same thing the pharmaceutical companies do on these ads. They give it a little three-letter nickname, and that makes it more ominous. So through the remainder of 2021 and into 2022, domestic violent extremist, parentheses, DVEs, including racially or ethnically motivated violent extremist and anti-authority / anti-government violent extremists will continue to pose a significant threat to our homeland. Of note, DVEs exploit online forums. They exploit online forums to influence and spread violent extremist narratives. The ongoing global pandemic continues to exacerbate these threats. So what are the topics that they're talking about? The pandemic, the authoritarian response to the pandemic on social media, on online forums. That's the source of this threat, is anybody who's anti-authority, it says that right here, and anti-government.
And these, anti-expert. I imagine they're anti-expert too.
Yeah, and they exploit the global pandemic. Here's another thing they exploit. The recent events in Afghanistan, it says they exploit recent events in Afghanistan. So as you know, David, anytime there's an ongoing ridiculous war like Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, there's always an embargo on bloody imagery and carnage and body parts being blown to pieces because they don't want people to be affected by that. You know, you might be sensitized and you might develop war fatigue, but
Look at what they did to Julian Assange when they had that leaked footage. They called it collateral murder, you know, where they had video footage of these guys deliberately killing a newsman. You could see that he had a camera. You could see what they were looking at, shooting it up. And then when the ambulance got there, they shot the ambulance up and they're laughing about it. They don't want you to see that kind of stuff. They don't even want and they don't want you to see the violence that happens to our own troops that are there either. They don't want you to see any of that. They want to sanitize it.
So they allowed you to see a glimpse of that carnage when the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So they have to say that's another thing you might exploit, these domestic violent extremists that are anti-authority. They might exploit the recent events in Afghanistan and the religious mass gatherings and the global pandemic. So in other words, you were allowed to see some carnage when Raytheon started losing some money. You know, these big military contractors started losing money because the paychecks might stop once we stop that 20-year war in Afghanistan. So you were allowed to see some carnage, you know, so the violence of war, you know, where it wasn't just this pretty thing, this wonderful thing that we're doing the Lord's work and nobody ever gets to see the actual reality of what's going on. So that's another thing that they noticed. Well, people might complain about what's going on in Afghanistan. But let me get to the worst parts here. It says the public needs to stay vigilant and report suspicious activity to law enforcement. Check this out. Department of Homeland Security is also engaging industry partners to help identify and respond to the spread of disinformation, conspiracy theories, and false narratives on social media and other online platforms. That's right here in this Homeland Security bulletin to all the sheriffs, that DHS is engaging with industry partners, that means Facebook, Twitter, Google, to help identify and respond to the spread of disinformation, conspiracy theories, and false narratives on social media and other online platforms. So what's misinformation? That's just anything that's opposing the authoritarian regime trying to shut you down and take your life away. If you just complain about the way the government's handling coronavirus, or you complain about how the government's handling anything else, you know, you say, oh, this pandemic is a scam, or global warming is a scam. If you say something like that, they want their industry partners to.
And this is a very old tactic. I mean, we've seen this in East Germany. What the Stasi did was, you know, tell us if somebody's complaining about the government. You know, they're complaining about their rations or something. We need to know that. And so this kind of Stasi snitch society is nothing new. What is new is the level that they've taken this to, where they've deputized these corporations and they have added the power of technology to this surveillance. I mean, what the Stasi was capable of doing was reprehensible, but it's nothing compared to what they're capable of doing with all the technology, the surveillance technology, and all the money, of course, that they're throwing to people as well. You know, we used to call those DVEs, we used to call that the PTA, didn't we?
Yeah.
Do they have something there about the school board stuff? Because that's become a hot topic.
It should have. They forgot that. That'll probably be in the next one. Don't complain about the school board or you're another DVE. And now you talk about the money. Let me get to how the rubber meets the road, that they're going to do grant funding interventions here. It says DHS is prioritizing combating all forms of terrorism and targeted violence and increased information sharing as part of the national strategy for countering domestic terrorism. So they give it a fancy name. To this end, the department has taken several steps to include what? To include establishing a dedicated domestic terrorism branch, domestic terrorism, within the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, forming the Center for Prevention Program and Partnerships. Did you notice the three P's? So they gave that an acronym, parentheses, CP3, not C3PO, but CP3, forming the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships, parentheses, CP3. So that makes it more legitimate with the little acronym, the initials. To do what? To provide communities with tools to help individuals before they radicalize to violence. And every one of these bulletins I've gotten since the beginning of the year talks about radicalization to violence. It mentions January 6th. And here's how they're going to do it. By increasing investments in grant programs to strengthen nationwide capabilities to detect and protect against these threats. So what does that mean? That means sheriffs and police are going to get grant money so that when somebody identifies somebody saying something anti-authoritarian on social media, the sheriff can respond to that because there's strings attached to that grant money where you have to implement some federal priority. And that's another topic I could get into.
And if you didn't have any principles, you would look at this and you'd say, oh, grant, how do I get this, right? How can I sign up and get on the feeding trough for all this? You know, Sheriff, talked about the CP3. They've also got a program that, interestingly enough, is centered around Microsoft. They put together this coalition. They call it the C2P. The C2PA, it's an alliance, but that's to basically identify everything, every document that you create, whether it is audio and video, whether it's an article, whether it's even a meme, they will identify it. And they put together this coalition between operating system manufacturers, between the CPU manufacturers, Intel, ARM, and others, and also with the people who are doing the apps, and they're in partnership with the BBC, the New York Times, and all the mainstream media, so they can identify you, and then everything that you produce will have an ID on it, so they can immediately shut that down if they see it coming from David Knight. That's where this is headed, and that's exactly what they want to do.
They used to use the euphemism metadata. Don't worry. Don't worry. It's like your data is mingled with everyone else. We can just tell if your phone went to some church meeting where there's a bunch of other people and you violated social distance. It's metadata. But you can tell from Governor Ducey's order, it's individually identifiable. And I know that from my time working with the feds. They had laws called like a CALEA, C-A-L-E-A, Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, that says there's no liability to a private company that shares anything that the feds ask for without a warrant. If they share it to help law enforcement, doesn't even need to go through a FISA court or anything like that. And, you know, this whole metadata thing, you know, when the Patriot Act and NSA started looking at everybody's emails and doing text search for the content, sort of suggesting that we just look at it as a big blob like metadata, but that's not true. You know, they have fusion centers where that stuff is individually identified and passed to federal agencies, you know, the FBI, DEA, Marshals, Secret Service, and things
like that. William Binney, I talked to William Binney, the former global technical head of the NSA for quite some time. He became a whistleblower after 9/11, and he said the metadata actually allows them to algorithmically process this a lot easier than if they were listening to your phone messages and what your phone conversations, and if they were reading your text. He said the metadata actually is even more valuable for them because it's more easily fed into the algorithm. So this whole thing has been growing for a very long time. You're talking about how they allow this, saying that this is data that can be turned over to them by the corporations. That was what they were doing back in the 1960s. That's where we wound up with the FISA court. But they take all of this stuff, even the FISA Act, you know, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that was actually used to enable them to spy on Mr. and Mrs. Verizon, as Rand Paul put it. They turn everything upside down, inside out, but it's been a long train of progression to spy on everything that we do and to deputize and pay people.
Yeah, those FISA courts are totally in secret too. Everything's totally confidential. So they can say, well, we're looking at metadata through the Patriot Act, and the big federal super squirrel, secret squirrel agencies are looking at all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's being kept compartmentalized. But no, as soon as they want something, a mass dump with individually identifiable stuff, they go to a FISA court, and it doesn't have to just address somebody individually. It can say anybody that fits these parameters. We want an order to be able to turn over these things to anybody that fits these parameters. And you don't get to see those FISA court orders or the affidavits or the applications. There's no openness or transparency. There's no, you know, there's not the adversarial process that you would have in a typical court procedure where both sides presents their case. Well, I want this, the government wants this, but then some attorney on the other side for a defendant, you know, says, well, no, it would be inappropriate. It would be a violation of privacy. So there's no adversarial process. They call it a court, but it's not a real court. They rubber stamp, you know, anything they want. And of course, the feds have always used money too. Like, you remember the 55 mile an hour speed limit in the 1970s. You know, it's like, well, how did that come about? Well, it's not a mandate. You don't have to do it. Well, if you want your federal highway money, then you have to do it. So they're always dangling this in front of the states and say, this will be a freebie. You don't have to raise taxes. Are you really want to get thrown out of office as a governor or as a local politician by not enacting these federal mandates so that you can get the money? So, and I think we've come full circle back to the idea of the lesser magistrates. I mean, what's the answer? I mean, you have to have somebody at the local level that you can stare in the face and say, look, you know, what are we going to do about this? And of course, me as a Christian, I don't see, you know, violence as being an answer to this. I think looking more to opting out and telling people, look, if you opt out, I'm a placeholder for this position right now as sheriff. If you opt out, I'm not going to do anything to you. If you opt out to mask mandate, vaccine mandates, or, you know, anything else, I don't desire to do anything, you know, violent, to counter violence with violence, you know, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, nothing like that. But just that I won't, in this position, I will be in place of somebody else who might have been more authoritarian, who would want to do something to you if you don't go along with these things.
That's right. And that's what we need at all these different levels. And so we're seeing that at, I think, the place where we're going to get somebody who is, and I'd like to have you on because I want to give people hope. I mean, there are other sheriffs out there that will stand for the rule of law, for the Constitution. We've seen, unfortunately, as a lot of this stuff was starting to roll out back in 2020, you would see videos that would start to surface on social media, and it would be from somebody who was in law enforcement, and they would say, I refuse to do this to people. I'm not going to be a part of this, and this is my farewell. I've been an officer for a long time, and they're going to fire me because I won't enforce these rules. And so we've seen this type of thing happening over and over again. The problem is, in most cases, these people are purged out. And so that's why it's important when we have a local elected office like sheriff or like mayor or city council, if we can get the people in who will hire these types of officers who are going to stand by the Constitution, who are not going to enforce this, they have to depend and they have to bribe you in order to get this enforced. And that's the important thing. And that's where the interposition is very, very important. So I just wanted to, that's one of the main reasons I it's interesting what you are showing people about what the federal government's designs are and what they're telling people about and how they're incentivizing all this stuff. But I want to give people an incentive to understand that if you can find the right people, just like Sheriff Hathaway, he's lived in that area for several generations. His family has been there. They have a commitment. They know the community, and they're not going to betray the people that are there. That's what we have to have. We have to build our societies from the ground up, and you're a great example of that, Sheriff.
Well, thank you. And, you know, my perspective is all from the Christian perspective of how I make my decisions, you know, like I have I believe in like market principles, price signals, you know, the society gets what they want in the free market, you know, and the Bible has like the parable of the wheat and the tares growing side by side. It's not our job to go exterminate wicked people. You know, some people would like to interpret Romans chapter 13 to mean something like that. We need to sort of listen to politicians and say, oh, those people over there on the other side of the hill, they're all, you know, going to kill us. You know, like Hitler could say that Poland is a serious threat. We need to invade and kill and stomp, you know, and it's like there were nothing in strength compared to all his panzer divisions and whatnot. So, you know, it's not our job to, the disciples asked Jesus, you know, so, you know, it kind of is that our job to root out the wicked and deal with them in this life? No, you know, that's up to God, you know. Mm-hmm. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. He'll sort that out at Judgment Day. But we live side by side with people who give in to wickedness, to give in to the temptations, and it's not our job to attack and kill and stomp those people, you know, like,
that's right.
You know, as it says in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, pray for your enemies, love your enemies, turn the other cheek. If somebody forces you to go a mile, you know, says here, carry my burden a mile, you should go a second mile voluntarily, you know. That's if right. They take your coat, you should offer them your cloak too. So it's like that mentality of the Christian, but it doesn't say you're not living in fear. You don't have fear, but you don't give in to evil either. And like in my position, my only goal is to give people the option to not go along with this nonsense and to tell them I'm not going to compel anybody to do any of this stuff. I'm operating on Christian principles. And if we have the time, I'd like to kind of go back to something you started out this interview about the border issues.
Sure.
The border issue is such a huge topic that I usually don't get into it on podcast. I'm actually going to be on a panel forum with Scott Horton, the great anti-war, commentator at the State Libertarian Convention on January 16th in Tucson for the State Libertarian Party for Arizona, to actually try to help them come up with a concise statement about the immigration and about the border and about mm-hmm. those things. So it's a huge topic, and you know, libertarians disagree on both sides of that topic. But if I can just say some things, we have to be careful. We have to be careful what we say. Like conservatives and libertarians have been saying for the past year and a half, well, all these people come across the border without masks, without PCR tests, without vaccines, without. guess what? They finally this week opened up the border to the people who have legal documents in Mexico. There's a lot of people that have visas in Mexico. They haven't been allowed to cross and shop for the past year and a half.
Yeah.
But guess what they did? The state will always look at the weak point to think like, where can we clamp down on a vaccine mandate? So you know what they did? They saw the right, the people on the right don't object to vaccine or mask mandates on people coming from other countries. The people on the left want everybody to wear a mask and have a vaccine. So there's no pushback here. So what do? On December 8th, they allowed people to start coming in shopping, the ones that have legal papers from Mexico. But they said, you have to be vaccinated.
Yep.
And you have to have proof of vaccination.
Wow.
So you have to be careful what you ask for, you know, like mm-hmm. when people push back on saying, well, all these people from Mexico, they're not PCR tested. They might be carrying COVID and infecting all of us. But on the other side of the mouth, those people are saying it's a scamdemic. It's fake. The COVID virus has never been isolated. Delta variant has never been isolated. But when it comes to like foreigners saying, well, they're coming across and they're not vaccinated and not wearing masks. So the feds detect that thing, that there will be no pushback from the right or the left.
That's right.
Only a libertarian would notice this phenomena. And so they require everybody coming from Canada or Mexico starting this week. Now they're allowing people to come into shop that have B1 or B2 visas. So these are people who have papers. But you have to show vaccination status. Why? Because they sense that nobody will push back. And now that's the nose of the camel's nose under the tent.
That's right.
Is now you have a federal agency making a vaccine mandate on masses of people, on thousands of people, and making them show their papers and show proof of vaccination status. So,
and I've seen something like that when it comes to illegal immigration, which, again, you know, the Republicans want cheap workers and the Democrats want available voters. And so you have this, it's been floating around for quite some time, the idea that everybody should have to get permission from Washington before they get a job. And that's kind of being promoted from the right as a means to control immigration. They don't right. get to the source of this, which is the incentivization or the yeah. welfare state or something like that. Instead, they focus on something that is off to the side. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, but I don't want to have Washington's permission to get a job. And that's what's basically going to happen.
Yeah.
So you're having your trade, your legitimate legal trade being shut down with vaccine mandates. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And then what they should do, the whole immigration thing, what they should do, there should be no magnets.
That's right.
To immigration, no Section 8 housing, no food stamps, you know, no welfare, no free hospitalization, you know, free, you know, public education where, and then it would be down to like people say, well, they're all coming here to get on the welfare rolls or to vote for the Democrat Party, to vote for socialism. Well, get the root of the problem is getting rid of the magnet that would attract anybody here for nefarious reasons. And if I can, if we have time, touch on one more thing that's related to the border, but it's kind of unrelated to what we're talking about, you know, with all Trump's walls and things like that, and encouraging, you know, everybody goes through the legal ports of entry. Guess what's happened in the last 10 years? Like the biggest problem with the Berlin Wall was keeping people from leaving the country.
That's right.
Keeping people from leaving. Guess what
Ron Paul used to always say? He said, remember, if you put a wall up, that can keep you from getting out. So is that what's happening now?
Yeah. 10 years ago, this started. I was the head of one of the federal agencies here on the border, federal law enforcement agencies. They started a pilot program of searching people leaving the United States, U.S. officers searching people leaving the United States, occasionally, sporadically, every other car. And I asked at the time the port director, what legal authority do you do this under? And they said, well, we have border search authority to search. But I told him, I thought that was for people coming in. He goes, no, well, we define it to mean anybody at the border. So when you're going into Mexico, they reach in and they take money, even if it's under the CTR valuation reporting limit of $10,000 for incoming, maybe $1,000, $2,000. They just grab people's money at the border and then do it under civil asset forfeiture. Mm. Don't file any charges, and you have to file a claim and cost bond to contest that to prove that it's from a legitimate source. Wow. You're not a drug dealer returning that to Mexico. So that was a pilot program 10 years ago. Guess what? Now, you know, you talk about making the walls, you know, more where people can't move. Now it's permanent. They've built a permanent structure. It used to be just a shade awning in the southbound lanes, but now you have CBP officers full-time inspecting cars going into Mexico here in my town. So if you're looking to expatriate from the U.S. and take your gold coins or your money with you, they're actually making it now harder to leave the U.S. Where you're getting searched by American authorities as you leave the U.S. So this is just one of those things you have to be aware of when you start saying, let's shut down the whole border and make everybody go through the official, you know, checkpoints, the official inspection stations. They're searching people that are leaving now and
taking very
money.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I haven't gone to Mexico, but I remember when we went into Canada and it was there were only, you know, the Canadians would check you when you came into Canada and the Americans would check you when you came back into America. They were checking people
and, you
when
know,
you went out.
And now it's like the Border Patrol, they'll pull me over and interrogate me and make me sit by the side of the road. And I'm obviously a gringo, 6 feet, 4 inches tall, 240 pounds, American driver's license, American license plates on my car. I won't argue with them and be contrarian. That's not my nature. But they've told me they have the constitutional authority to do that. They've come and swarmed me and pulled guns on me and my children on our own ranch land and say, and when I've been detained for like half an hour at a time, I'll say like, well, what authority do you have for this? We have extended border search authority within 100 miles of the U.S. border. We can search anybody. The Supreme Court's given us that authority. And people may not realize this, but 2/3 of the American population lives within 100 miles of the border. So here, they don't need PC, and they've told me we don't need probable cause. We have extended border search authority within 100 miles of the border. So I know every church across the U.S. says, you know, pray for the Border Patrol. They have them in their church bulletins. But here, we live in a police state. Mm-hmm. The federal agents outnumber local officers 30-1. We have the biggest Border Patrol office in the nation in my county, smallest county in Arizona, and we have the third biggest Border Patrol office in the nation. We have the largest ports of entry of any county in Arizona. We have a very large DEA office, ICE office, HSI, Forest Service, other federal agencies here. And like I say, the federal agents outnumber 30-1, not counting when the National Guard troops are here as well. And it really is kind of a constitution-free zone where you can just be pulled over Like I was sitting in a creek on ranch land that I own in the bottom of the creek playing with my sons, and I hear sounds in the bushes. Border Patrol swarms up on me, points guns at us, and says, "What are you doing here? You shouldn't be here." And I said, "Well, I own this. This has been in my family, this property, since before Arizona was a state, since the 1800s. And they go, "No, you don't own it. This isn't your land. This is dangerous. You shouldn't be here." And I had a model 1911 45 automatic in my waistband behind me. I was sitting down in the creek with my boys digging in the water on our ranch, and I didn't dare stand up. I think I'm going to get shot. So people that just think that a police state down here on the border is a good idea, you should witness it yourself. You That's should right. witness the, you know, it's not a market signal. It's not a price signal. The number of federal agents here doesn't equate to the price signals from the market of how much demand there is for that. So anyway, it's a big topic.
Yeah,
and it's not, amazing. It's something.
Well, people need to understand. People need to
understand. If we ever talk about this, David, we'd have to pray for it and have a lot of grace, because we may have different opinions on this. Mine is kind of just driven purely from Christian perspective and thinking, you know.
I agree. It's been fascinating talking to Sheriff David Hathaway. Thank you so much, sir, for what you're doing and for the information. Thank you. Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com. All right, and I'm glad we're able to still proceed with this interview. I had Matt Trehuela set up to talk about his book, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. We talked a little bit about that last time, and this is really the barricade that we need to be erecting, and that is to do this from the bottom up. From the top down, this thing is under control, and if we're going to rework society, it is going to be from the bottom up, and this is one of the best ways I can see of doing this, organizing communities, organizing churches, and getting people to stand on principle when we have other magistrates in different jurisdictions, or people, even magistrates that are at a higher level of authority, who are pushing back against the Constitution. We need to push back against them. We need to understand where the legitimate authority is. So joining us now is Matt Trehuela. Did I pronounce your name correctly, Matt? Is that correct? Trehuela?
Pretty good. It's Trehuela.
Yep. Okay. All right. Good. Let's talk about this a little bit. Just recap briefly for people what we talked about last time a little bit. The whole idea of the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, some of the precedents that were set with this historically.
Sure. Well, the doctrine itself is that when the higher ranking civil authority makes unjust or immoral law, policy, or court opinion, the duty of the lesser ranking civil authority is not to blithely obey, rather their duty is to interpose and not obey, and if necessary, to actively resist. So their duty is interposition. We talked about, you know, Emperor Trajan kind of succincted the whole doctrine when he was giving a sword to one of his subordinates. He said, "Use this sword against my enemies if I give righteous commands, What if I give unrighteous commands, use it against me? And we also noted John Knox has written the foremost treatise on the doctrine of the lesser magistrate in his 1558 appellation to the nobles of Scotland. The nobles were the lesser magistrates of their day. He cited over 70 passages of scripture to show that the doctrine is sound in the Word of God.
And let's just kind of interject some current events, because we've had just in the last couple of days, we've had the governor of Oklahoma appoint a new head of the Oklahoma National Guard who said, we're not going to do the vaccine mandates. Now, we have, so there's a couple of different issues that are at play here. First of all, we have the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, which in a sense, I don't know, would you agree with this, Matt? You look at the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. If they don't have certain powers delegated to them, they don't have those powers in the first place. So in that particular case, you're talking about a constitutional separation of powers, not a lesser magistrate against a higher magistrate. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that. Absolutely.
And with this National Guard thing, let me just say, okay, so we agree with that, and we're all on the same page with that. With this National Guard thing, you have somebody in, the military chain of command. Now, that truly is a lesser magistrate who is saying, no, we're not going to do this. And he's saying that to his higher-ups, because that is a chain of command, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I talk about that in my book, the military and the duty of lower officers to stand in a position against the superior officers when they make immoral or unjust orders. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we continue to see acts of interposition by lesser authorities across the country. Just this last week also, David, there was a city in California which has defied the entire state regarding all this COVID nonsense, or I should say the COVID evil, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
So it's good. Here's a city defying an entire state, standing in a position to protect the people in their jurisdiction from the states and Gavin Newsom's evil edicts. It's encouraging to see.
That's right. Yeah, when this was reported, the military, when they reported this Oklahoma National Guard commander, they said he goes rogue. That's the way they're going to attack people, that he went rogue. No, he's a hero. I tweeted out, I said, no, he's a hero, because they take an oath to defend the Constitution, not just, I like the Constitution, but to defend it. That's really what is involved here. That really is what we're talking about with the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, isn't it?
Yeah, he's not going rogue. He's not creating chaos. Mm-hmm. He's trying to restore order by faithfully executing his lawful office.
That's right. Talk a little bit about the history of the Magdeburg Confession and what was behind that. Maybe a little bit about John Knox. And I want to talk a little bit about what is going on with the Supreme Court, because ultimately I think this stuff is all going to get drawn into that. And there's a whole lot to talk about when we talk about that hierarchical structure that I don't think is constitutional. And what are people who have legitimate power going to do about that? But give us a little bit more about the background of this. And again, the book is The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. Excellent book. This is another book I recommend that you get, and it's a lot quicker read than the RFK Jr. book. This is packed with information, very, very quick read, one of the best books that I have seen in a long time, Matt's book, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrate. And where can they get that? Is it Defy Tyrants, your website?
DefyTyrants.com.
Yes,
yeah. DefyTyrants.com.
DefyTyrants.com. It's also available on Amazon, but of course, we don't want to feed that beast if we can. And he's got some special deals. I think if you go to your website, you got some special deals as part of that package if they buy it directly from you. Is that correct?
That's correct. We throw in a few items they won't get if they order from Amazon.
Good, good. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the history. Just give people a brief introduction, a little bit more depth about Magdeburg and maybe something about John Knox.
Sure. I have a chapter in my book on the Magdeburgers and the Magdeburg Confession. It was the first time that the doctrine of the lesser magistrates was formalized by Christian men. It is a Christian doctrine. It's the product of Christian thought, and it's brought a great goodness to Western civilization, of course, which is all being trampled by the tyrants now. But we actually secured a 1550 original of the Magdeburg Confession. It was written in Latin. All important theological works were back then, translated into the German and sent out throughout the entire Holy Roman Empire. But no one had ever translated into English. So we secured a 1550 original from the Bavarian State Library in Munich, Germany, I hired a guy with a PhD in Latin and Greek, impeccable credentials. He's from Cornell University, Christian brother. He did the translation work. A brother named George Grant wrote the introduction. I wrote a historical prelude and historical postscript to it so that people could see the context in which it was written. And we added many footnotes so that people would get the punch, David, of what these guys were referring to. Because if you don't know what they were referring to, you don't see the impact of what they were saying. So this confession was written by Churchman.
Are you selling that?
In
Magdeburg. Let me ask you that. This
yes,
with the foreword and everything. So you're also selling that at your site?
Yes, we are.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Magdeburg Confession. And you'll see this odd beast on the cover of it. It's actually a werewolf. And people contact us all the time. What is that strange creature on the cover of the Magdeburg Confession? And we tell them it's a werewolf. A werewolf was a creature, a monster from German folklore. And Martin Luther actually used the werewolf as a symbol of tyrannical government.
Well, it's not Beowulf, right?
Yes.
It's not Beowulf, it's Beowulf. Werewolf.
Werewolf, yes.
As young Frankenstein would say. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, the soldiers who fought at Magdeburg sang songs about the werewolf, and the pastors who wrote the Magdeburg Confession refer to the werewolf also in regards to tyrannical government. And you know, David, scripture often applies a beast to tyrannical government officials.
That's right.
So it was in keeping with biblical thought that way.
Yeah, most of the governments that tend to like to represent themselves as some kind of a predator creature. I don't know why that is. I don't.
Yes.
Yeah.
But here's why the confession was written. In 1546, after Luther had died, Charles V tried to make his move. God had prevented it in his providence all those decades so the Reformation could get deeper and stronger in nations across Europe. But when Luther died, Charles V decided to make his move, and he issued his Augsburg Interim, which was to bring all of the Protestant lands back under Catholic practice, belief, and rule. And there was only one city that actually stood in defiance, and that was Magdeburg, Germany. And it is the story of a city that defied an empire and won. They issued their Magdeburg Confession in April 1550, and Charles V marched on the city in November of 1551. And there was a battle that went on for 13 months. Over 4,000 of Charles's men were killed. 468 Magdeburgers were killed. But in the end, the Magdeburgers won the day. So you have to understand how important their interposition was, David. Mm-hmm. If it had not been for the interposition of Magdeburg, the Reformation would have likely been just a blip on the radar screen of human history. That's how important their interposition was.
That's true. And you
so
point out,
put out this.
And let me interject here. You point out in chapter 10 of your book, the response of a tyrannical magistrate. They're not going to just set back, and eventually push is going to come to shove with these people. But it must begin with them, right? We're going to stand for this. I've had many people say, well, you know, there's only one solution to all this. You know, we got to fight them and so forth. I don't want to make the mistake of initiating an unjust war. We do what is justified, and then we respond accordingly. If we are attacked, we defend ourselves, right? You talk about that in terms of response of the tyrannical magistrate. Is that correct? Would you agree with that?
I do, and that is why the Magdeburgers, they were defending themselves.
Yes.
Charles
yes.
marched on them. They were standing in defense of their faith. He was trampling it, doing many other injustices also. And what's interesting is that the churchmen understood their role in this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they wrote this confession, to show the world that their magistrates were right. They showed them from scripture, and they showed them from history in their confession that their magistrates were right to defy the emperor.
Yes.
The first signer of the confession was a man named Nicholas von Amsdorf. Amazing history. He was at the University of Wittenberg with Luther while Luther was there also. He was with Luther when he pounded his 95 theses on the church door. He was with Luther in Worms when Luther was being tried as a heretic. He was with Luther when a lesser magistrate, Frederick the Wise, feigned his abduction and put him in the Wartburg castle there in Eisenach, Germany, wherein Luther was able to write the New Testament into German, giving the German people their first unified language. So this is the guy who signed. So he had seen the interposition, Nicholas von Amsdorff did, had already seen the interposition of a lesser magistrate, Frederick the Wise, back in 1521. He was directly under Charles V. Charles had ordered the arrest of Luther, and instead of arresting him, this lesser magistrate feigned his abduction and placed him in the castle in Wartburg. Nobody knew if Luther was alive or dead for nearly a year. So here it is, 1546. They write this confession showing that their magistrates are, so they're the first ones to have formalized this doctrine. It's massively important. There's three parts to it. The second part deals with, the first part is just straight up boilerplate Lutheran theology. They wanted to assure all the magistrates and the other churchmen that they stood foursquare with Luther. They were Lutheran ministers. The second part is all about the doctrine of the second of the lesser magistrate. And the third part is about the suffering and human nature, the things people go through when tyranny is in the land. It is a tremendous read. Mm-hmm. I cannot encourage people strongly enough. John Knox, Theodore Beza, Mornay, Hotman, they all, Christopher Goodman, they all furthered the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, but they all held in esteem these ministers from Magdeburg because they were the first to have actually formalized it.
And, you know, when we look at what was involved there, again, it was religious freedom that was involved there. And when we have the Declaration of Independence, they do essentially the same thing. They're saying, you know, we've had this long train of abuses. Their focus in that document was the idea that we would have not lose our representation, that we would not have, for example, taxation without representation. So they talk about a long train of political abuses. But there was a very, very important part of the American Revolution, the Black Regiment, that was also still defending religious freedom because so many people had fled from Europe and from the UK, especially because of religious persecution there. That was a major impetus. And they're trying to sweep that away in American history. They want to make it simply about the Jamestown settlement, for example, instead of the Mayflower. And that's why they always escalate this and put out the 1619 stuff so that you forget about 1620 and a different approach to people's understanding of the founding of America. But in the Declaration of Independence, it was important for them to lay out the causes of this and how their cause was just. We seem to have completely ignored that anymore. When we go to war, there's very little opportunity for us even. We don't bother to even debate. We just have an executive who decides they're going to go preemptively strike, isn't it?
It is. And it's the duty of Congress to declare war, not the president. And that's been a problem. People should study the just war theory. Yes. There's a lot they can learn from that. I've done a number of sermons on that doctrine. And, you know, early churchmen formulated the just war theory in early Christianity and have talked about it and we've debated things for centuries.
And we've completely gotten away from it. And it was that kind of value that was inculcated into society, but not explicitly talked about. And that's why we've now lost it, I think. You know, it was when we were attacked by the Japanese preemptively in Pearl Harbor, they had a military reason to do it first, and they knew that we were essentially had committed to the other side and were supplying the other side. But it was still, as FDR said, a day that would live in infamy because it was a preemptive attack. And yet now we talk about preemptive attacks all the time. That's just our regular strategy because we never talked about the just war theory. We never explicitly talked about the principles involved here. So now we're just looking at this from a tactical standpoint, not from an ethical, moral standpoint.
Absolutely. And the Magdeburgers understood those things and they make their case and they tell the emperor, we will obey you in all things, but we cannot obey you in this. You have exceeded your lawful limits for your authority. Our allegiance is to Christ first. We must stand resolute. And they did.
Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, because when I think of government out of control, before this stuff happened with COVID, I had begun ending my programs with, oh, and one more thing. judicial supremacy must be destroyed, kind of referring back to Cato, what he said about Carthage at the end of his speeches, because it was, it is this essential thing that has really destroyed our country, because judicial supremacy has created not a compartmentalized government of checks and balances that's the design in the Constitution, legitimate government. It's created this top-down structure, and it's put the Supreme Court at the very top of this. And I know you've talked a lot about the Supreme Court, going back to Roe v. Wade, but now everything, including these vaccine mandates and everything else, are going to be scrutinized by all the courts and will eventually be decided by the Supreme Court. And we've had some horrific decisions already by the Supreme Court in terms of what's been happening with COVID lockdowns. And we're going to see, I think, some horrific decisions when it comes to vaccine mandates from them as well. Talk a little bit about the Supreme Court. You've been, you've talked a great deal about this. You've talked about this in presentations and conferences. Give us your take of what is going on. What is the rightful way for us to respond to this? What should not even lesser magistrates, state governments, they're not lesser magistrates when it comes to the Supreme Court, but what should they do to exercise this division of power?
Yeah, the state governments have become de facto, provinces to the federal government, but our founders never intended that. You're exactly right on that. Mm-hmm. And no, I tell every magistrate I meet with, regardless of what stripe they're from, what level of government, what branch they're from, I tell them all, the Supreme Court must be defied. The federal judiciary must be defied. They have been the dispensers of injustice and immorality upon this nation for decades. I'm 61 years old now, David. I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't need to read a book about it. I've watched how they take generation after generation and corrupt them further and further by imposing these things on the nation through broad judicial power, not done by representative government at all.
That's right.
So this matter of judicial supremacy, I think it's massively important that we teach the magistrates that it's a fiction, that it's a lie. Mm-hmm. And so the three parts of judicial supremacy are that the issued opinions of SCOTUS are the law of the land. That's a lie. The second is that they are the final arbiter of all constitutional questions. That's a lie. The third lie is that every other branch of government must bow down to SCOTUS in whatever they decree. That is a lie.
That's right.
And you can go through them very easily to dismantle this lie to the magistrates where they can see it clearly. And once you dismantle them, by the way, David, then you're dealing with the bigger problem, which is cowardice. But here's the first thing that we have to respond to when it says, when they say that Supreme Court opinions are the law of the land. And every newscaster says it, every school teacher, every lawyer, of course, even the pro-life, pro-family groups say it, and aid and abet a lie while the preborn continue to get butchered.
That's right.
Homosexual marriage continues on throughout the land.
That's right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, let me just interject here.
Article
Matt.
One, section.
Let me interject here momentarily. I know we had a little bit of a lag there. It was already starting to move in the way of states taking the lead on all of this, even after Roe v. Wade. And it was ironically the religious community that got behind Reagan and said, no, the way we're going to proceed with this is we're going to elect Reagan and he's going to put conservative justices on the Supreme Court. So let's forget that Ninth and Tenth Amendment approach. And now what we have is something that has become not just even important. It's very, very important in terms of the fact that we don't decide the personhood of some humans based on their age or physical condition. That's going to have implications for all of us at every age, not just for the unborn. But that's bad enough. And then what they did was they used this to establish a precedent that they will essentially craft the law of the land. And even referring to it, I would add, saying that this is now constitutional. This is against the Constitution if you're going to go against Roe v. Wade. I've actually heard them say that. Not just it's the law of the land, but it's essentially new constitutional law.
Yes. No. And people need to understand about that, David. The Republicans stampede Christian people to vote for their presidential candidate every 4 years under the mantra of, hey, whoever's elected president gets to appoint the Supreme Court justices. But what you have to understand is that Republican appointed justices outnumbered Democratic appointed justices when Roe v. Wade was ruled upon 6-3.
That's right.
6 were Republican, 3 were Democrat. And for the next 35 plus years after that, the Republicans had the majority the entire time, either 8-1 or 7-2, with many changes of justices taking place over those years and reappointments by Republicans. They have used this as a means to keep getting votes from Christians when the proper response is what you said, Ninth and Tenth Amendment, the interposition.
That's right.
And that's what our founders expected. When the federal government acted lawlessly, they expected the states to interpose. We see this with James Madison, even, who was the architect of the U.S. Constitution. Just 11 years after the ink had dried in the Alien and Sedition Acts, the federal government had exceeded their limits as revealed in the Constitution. Two states defied them, one of them being Virginia. James Madison wrote the resolution in defiance of federal lawlessness. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Kentucky Resolution. So this is what our founders expected the states to do, not blithe compliance to something so evil and wicked. They expected the states to stand in interposition and defy the federal government if it behaved lawlessly.
That's right. And instead, what they're doing is they're just falling in place. And when we saw the confirmation hearing of Barrett, she said, oh, no, well, you know, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. And I've said, Matt, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I said, you know, we go back and we look at Marbury versus Madison, where they said we have the right to review every law for its constitutionality. And I think that Roe v. Wade has become as important to them, not just because they can use it, as you pointed out, to get Republicans elected, but I think it's become as important to SCOTUS in terms of establishing their quote-unquote authority to determine what law is and to craft new law, not just to determine when personhood begins, but also to do things like redefining marriage, as we've now seen. And now you've got, yes, it's going to work its way up, all these different types of things. You've got the California Supreme Court is now going to decide if pronoun misuse can get you locked up in jail. And I imagine that that's going to make its way all the way up to the Supreme Court as well.
Yep. And the executive branches and the legislative branches love it this way because they can say, oh, I agree with you about that. Mm-hmm. But the Supreme Court has ruled all that. And then they hide behind the skirt of the court all the while. Their duty is interposition. And that's where the role of the people come in. The people must demand of their magistrates that they interpose.
Yes.
And they must assure their magistrates at the state, county, and local level that if they do interpose, that they will stand foursquare with them, with their person, with their property, with their prayers, both publicly and privately. That's extremely important for people to understand.
Yes.
So when it comes to this first part of the fiction of judicial supremacy, you know, that Supreme Court opinions are the law of the land, just go to Article 1, Section 1 of our U.S. Constitution. And it says right there that all lawmaking power shall reside in Congress, which consists of a House and a Senate. Now, I would get A's in every subject, David, except math. I always got D's. And when they brought letters into math, I could never cross that Rubicon. So it's just like, but even Matt Truella understands that if all lawmaking power resides with Congress, how much lawmaking power does that leave to the judiciary? And that's right, zero. So, and this is why after the Obergefell, in the Obergefell opinion, when Scalia wrote his dissent to Obergefell, he said that the actions of the court are not only legislative, they're super legislative power, a means of government completely at odds to the founding of our fathers or something according to that.
Yes, and that's the decision that defined marriage as homosexual. And this is in defiance of every state. You had state constitutions. You had state legislation. You even had referenda across many different states. Even in California, that notion, yep, had been defeated. Even with, yeah, millions and millions of dollars from Tim Cook and from Apple Computer, and in California, that lost. And what the Supreme Court did, 9 politically appointed people, unaccountable to anyone, what they did was they defied every move of the people and of the states and of the state constitution, and they enacted their own preference.
Absolutely. And what did the Republican governors do? Like Scott Walker was the governor here, great conservative, right? And what did he do? He couldn't run to a microphone fast enough after that opinion was issued, to say that same-sex marriage is now the law of the land. That's exactly what he said in Wisconsin. And then he went on to say, at least now we can focus on things that are more important for children. That's what he said, like the economy. That's what we're left with this bankrupt, saltless conservatism that we have present in America today.
That's right.
It's awful to watch how they play that game and hide behind the court and get the evil done. But what our founders established, David, was a true federalism. I'm not talking about the federal government. I'm talking about federalism. And in a true federalism, you have multiple levels of government, multiple branches at each level. That way, if one branch or branches began to play the tyrant, another branch or branches could check them, could interpose against their evil. Mm-hmm. And our founders wanted it this way. There was to be no final arbiter.
That's right.
As the Supreme Court is now declared to be. Every magistrate from a policeman to the president takes an oath to uphold the Constitution. If they go against the Constitution, every other magistrate is to uphold it and stand in opposition. Instead, because it's the Supreme Court and they have become an oligarchy now, Jefferson warned about this. He was prescient about, he spent the last 23 years of his life at war with the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Because he saw that early on, they began to write their opinions. And in their opinions, they would accrue powers to themselves and to the government, the federal government, not granted to them in the U.S. Constitution.
That's right.
In fact, just 6 years after the ink dried on the Constitution, they did that in, I can't remember the case right now, they did that in a case. And that resulted in the 11th Amendment. That's how Congress responded to the lawlessness of the Supreme Court in their opinion, just 6 years after the ink had dried on the Constitution. But 24 years after that, the Supreme Court trampled the 11th Amendment. In fact, during the first 35 years of the Supreme Court, they wrote powers to themselves and to the federal government in 24 cases. Powers to themselves and powers to the federal government not granted to either in the U.S. Constitution. So this and then impugning the sovereignty of the states. Mm-hmm. And this is why Jefferson was at war with them the last 23 years of his life, as were many of the other founders, because they saw how everything was being corrupted.
That's right.
And get this, the early founders like Hamilton said that the judiciary would be the least dangerous. Madison said that they would be the weakest. And Jefferson said they would be the least, I can't remember what he said. But anyways, they viewed the judiciary as the weakest. And the reason Madison said that they were the least dangerous to our political freedoms was because they had no policing power.
That's right.
But here's who's given them their policing power. Mm-hmm. Governors, an opinion gets issued, and the governor declares it the law of the land. And that is an important point because get this, when the tyrant superior civil authority makes unjust or immoral law, how do they get their evil down into the fabric of society? Through the lesser authorities.
That's right.
So these state magistrates, county magistrates, local magistrates should be standing in defiance of the Supreme Court, but because of judicial supremacy, they're able to hide behind the lie, and the people are ignorant and they don't know better. And so they keep getting away from it. But everybody knows something's wrong. And that's why it's important for us to talk about this so people see what is wrong with judicial supremacy and how it was never intended by our founders.
Well, it's all about abdication. And we can see that, especially just if you look at the other two branches of the federal government, you look at the executive and you look at the legislative, you know, the legislature has typically punted its responsibility even for writing laws. They've kicked that over to the bureaucrats. And we can, that's another topic for discussion at another time. But what has happened more often than not, the executive branch, which has a lot of these bureaucratic agencies underneath it, and we can see this very clearly with what happened with immigration policy or with DACA under President Trump. He had made adamant promises to his base that he was going to stop the Dreamer program and he was going to do other things about immigration. And yet, even though that Dreamer program was based on an executive order from the previous president, he kicked it over to the Supreme Court and then waited for years for them to play around with it and then bowed to their decision, saying that he couldn't get rid of the executive order of the previous president. And that all worked out well for him because he could tell his base, look, I did everything that I could, but I was blocked by the Supreme Court and there's nothing I can do because, you know, there are masters. And that's the way all these politicians in both parties, whether it is the executive branch, the president, or whether it's the Congress, have done that. And, of course, we're seeing that happening all the time with the states. They don't really want to do anything either. They will put together, just as we've been talking about abortion, they'll put together an abortion bill and say, well, we got some new Supreme Court justices, so let's put together some different spins on the abortion bill. And let's see what they do with it. We'll send that up as a trial balloon to the Supreme Court and see if they'll let us do this now. That's the only response you get from the states.
Right. Absolutely. And it's called feigning a fight because what they're doing is they're telling the people what the people want to hear, that they're going to stand against these things, like what you mentioned about Trump and matters with states. They tell people that, but they only mean it till they lose in the courts. They're going to comply with whatever they say. Like right now, you have a number of governors, South Carolina, Florida, Alaska, totally saying great stuff, totally denouncing all of this vaccine mandate stuff, right?
Yep.
But we won't know if they really mean it or if they're just feigning a fight until the courts rule. Because ultimately, whenever the courts rule, then they say, well, we gave it a good show. We've really fought it.
That's
right. But the courts have ruled, all we can do now is obey. It's feigning a fight.
That's right.
It's wicked. And only the people can hold their magistrates accountable and demand their interposition against the lawlessness of the federal. There is no suicide pact in the U.S. Constitution. No suicide pact with us and the federal judiciary. The other branches must do their duty and interpose and exercise their lawful constitutional authority in opposition to the evil that they're trying to accomplish.
That's right. Yeah, when we look at DeSantis, and again, this week, he's been attacked by Politico, saying, well, this is nothing but posturing. And as you point out, we'll find out if it's nothing but posturing. They've called together a special session. They've got, he's issued some executive orders, and they've been able to get these things through so far, but they did allow these things to be challenged by the court. They just happened to win in court so far. And I've applauded him for thinking outside of just going and suing in court, which is what most of them will only go that far. Instead, they came up with some laws and some patterns, and they said, all right, well, you know, if Biden is going to fine you this much, we'll fine you even more. And and yet, to do this other thing. So they had this tug of war because it's always typically about the money. It's always about the fines. But it really will come down to it, because all of these things will ultimately be challenged by a court hearing. And quite frankly, I'm kind of guessing, Matt, that when they come together and they do this as a law, that's when the court challenge is going to happen. I think he probably hasn't had a challenge so far because they've been executive orders and they're pretending that they're, because they've declared a state of emergency. That has been the thing that has, been the magic authority to do everything they want. Well, we got an emergency and the governor can do whatever he wants. But once they put this into law, I think that's when the challenges are going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. And here's what the thinking that Christian men and women must get rid of. And that's that, well, you know, yeah, we don't like this ruling by the Supreme Court, but we like this other ruling by the Supreme Court.
That's right.
And therefore they think that they have to go along with the bad rulings because they give us a good ruling every now and then. Look, we applaud the Supreme Court when they give a good ruling. We should stand in interposition in defiance of them when they give a bad ruling, you know?
That's right.
So overcoming this is very important. But, you know, the second part of the fiction, you know, that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter. What's his name? Thomas Jefferson. He said, there is no such tribunal. It doesn't exist. Every magistrate takes an oath to uphold the Constitution. It's written at an eighth grade level. Anybody can understand it. If you don't understand a part, you can look into the history of what they discussed, what they talked about, so you can understand the thoughts and intents of their hearts regarding what they penned. It's not difficult. And we don't need these experts called lawyers or the Supreme Court or the federal judiciary in order to explain it to us. You know, we can understand it. So it's incredibly important that people realize this. They say that judicial supremacy is found in the Constitution in Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the U.S. Constitution. But interestingly enough, David, when you go to Article 6, Paragraph 2, which they call the Supremacy Clause,
right?
There is not there anywhere where the Supreme Court is mentioned, nor anywhere is the federal judiciary mentioned. What has the supremacy is the Constitution itself. That's what has the supremacy. And just two paragraphs later, the Constitution talks about the oath that every magistrate takes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is what matters.
Yeah.
Is the oath that they take. And when these magistrates see another branch of government impugning the Constitution, their duty is not blithe obedience. Their duty is interposition. I've told you, brought up Roe v. Wade. I've met with so many magistrates over the years regarding Roe. I dismantle this entire judicial supremacy fiction. They get it clearly. And then I say to them, I say, so where do you see in the Constitution that a woman or a woman and her husband have the right to murder their own son or daughter through abortion? And they look at me and they say, it's not in the Constitution. I go, you're right. It's not. Penumbras, emanations, they made it up out of thin air. So now, since they've impugned the Constitution, what is your duty, sir? And then I'm quiet. I don't say nothing. It's all sinking in. And now we're going to move to the more troubling problem to see interposition, and that's the cowardice of men.
That's right. That's right. You ever get anybody say, that's right, we're going to ignore it? Or do they just, you ever get anybody give you the right answer with that, that you've talked to?
We do get people give us the right answer, but then they get together with all of the Republican caucuses and the pro-life, pro-family groups, and they decide to just keep going along with the cozy arrangement.
Well, they go wobbly. And I think that's the key thing, because we're going to have a mass of people. And so you have a chapter in your book, The Role of the People. And I think the role of the people, part of it is that, as you mentioned earlier, we don't want to jump into this end justifies the means. You know, if I can get what I want, all right, I'll embrace judicial supremacy. And then I'll fight it on the, you know, but once you embrace it because you think that you're going to win on this particular issue, you've lost. And yes. and you've lost the Constitution, you've lost the Bill of Rights, you've lost all of this. And so we cannot allow the principle to be lost just for a pragmatic moment here. And so I think that's one of the key things that we, the people, need to understand and stand for. What are some of the other things that that people can do? What is the other part of the role of the people from a practical standpoint and even from a theoretical standpoint?
Well, I think it's very important that we speak to our culture, our society at large, you know, out on the soapbox, out in the public square. We go to the universities and speak to the college students. I'm a churchman, and I think this is massively important for us to, and you know, David, the vast majority of Christians never share their faith.
That's right.
They never defend the law or word of God, never make known his great salvation to men. They keep to themselves. They've been hoodwinked by this relationship evangelism idea that you have no right to talk to people about the things of God or about salvation in Christ until you establish a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And I love Ray Comfort's little video where he talks to all kinds of Christians who believe that. And then he asks them, you know, so how long have you known this person? 2 years, they'll say 3 years, even 4 years. And then he asks them, he says, and at what point did you share the gospel with them? And every one of them says, well, I haven't actually done that yet. You know, and it's like, it's because I learned early on as a young Christian, you better make known you're a Christian right away. You get into the workplace, tell everybody, you know, let them know. They're all watching you then. And then it's amazing how people come and want to talk to you privately about the matters of God. What does he think about this? Mm-hmm. And what does he think about that? And can you pray for me? And I have a family member who's sick and that type of thing. We should be, you look at the early church, they were out there causing no small stir everywhere they went. So I believe that's an important role of the people also, is to teach and instruct the populace at large in Christian thought.
That's right. And when we talk about the magistrates, right, we're talking about them going wobbly. Right. You just talked about, well, I go out and I talk to these people and, you know, I lay this out for them and they realize, oh, yeah, that's against the Constitution. I should be doing something about that. And then we as Christians fall in the same place. Right. Because ultimately, you know, I'm not talking I'm not jumping in with Flynn. I don't want to see this as one nation. I want to see it as one nation under God, but not under one religion. He doesn't even mention which religion. So I'm not really sure, since he's had some unusual prayers that he's led in various places. But I want to see this come about not from a top down imposition, but this has to come from a genuine turning that is one person at a time. And if we're afraid one person at a time to talk about this because we don't want to offend somebody, we're never going to get off the ground, and we're not going to help anybody in the most important question of life, which is even more important than these political issues. Yes. But that's really what's going to be the basis of turning this country around. It's going to be one person at a time. And it's really going to be you. It's not going to be some great crusade by some guy who is an eloquent preacher, you know, Billy Graham or something. That's not going to change the country. It's going to be changed one person at a time.
Yes. Theology is what gives people the grit to stand against tyrants and tyranny.
That's right.
And that's why it's so important for us to. And as you know, the vast majority of pulpits in America have played the whore, David, and have not been faithful or true to Christ. It's a huge problem. I believe that's part of why the tyrants have been unleashed upon our nation, is because judgment begins in the house of the Lord.
Yes. And that's a real tactic of theirs to say that if you're doing something that I'm offended by, if it hurts my feelings, whatever you're saying, that's why we get back to this whole thing about pronouns, right? If you use a different pronoun, I demand that you use this pronoun. It's like, well, that's a trespass on me and my religious beliefs. If you're going to impose that upon me, how about that? So they don't demand that you tolerate what they're doing even. They demand that you celebrate what they're doing. And then if you don't celebrate what they're doing, then they will punish you, and you're the hateful person and so forth. So we've allowed this these rules to be set up. Just as they set up speech rules, we have rules for society and how we are to interact with people. And it is not a multilateral tolerance. It is going in one particular direction. And we got there because we're afraid of people, and we're afraid to stand up for what we believe and to speak about what we believe, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the phony churchmen and the secularists, the statists, have sold this evil under the guise of love, and they've redefined love. You have to understand, if you divorce the ethic of love from Scripture, you can justify anything. You can even justify two men or two women marrying each other. So it's extremely important that we understand how to love people, and that's telling them the truth. You know, so this is extremely important. You know, I wouldn't wear a mask while all this masking. I've never worn a mask. I can't do it. And, you know, people say, well, look, you should do the loving thing, you know, and wear the mask. And I'm like, no, that's not the loving thing, because this whole COVID thing has been built on a mountain of lies. And the ninth commandment says you shall not bear false witness. Exodus 23 verse 2 talks about not joining in those who are spreading a lie. And when I wear a mask, that's what I'm doing. And in fact, in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, Paul says in verse 6 that love doesn't rejoice in iniquity. And this whole COVID thing is bellowing with iniquity. And then he says, rather it rejoices in the truth. Christians show love to others by telling them the truth, by aiding and abetting a lie.
That's right. Yeah, and as it's just so filled with greed and corruption and domination and slavery. It's not love to embrace that. It's cowardice to embrace that, isn't it? Yeah, you're exactly right. Well, thank you so much, and I want to get you back on again to talk about this and so many other issues. Again, the book is The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates by Matthew Truella. Did I pronounce it correctly that time? And you can find it at...
You did.
good. Okay. I'll keep practicing at defytyrants.com. Try to get it there instead of at Amazon. We don't want to feed any more money to Jeff Bezos and his people. And he's got some special things for you if you get it at defytyrants.com. Thank you so much, Matt. Appreciate you coming on. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Very important issues. We're going to take a quick break, folks, and we'll be right back. I want to hit on a couple of news stories since we've got a late start today. And so we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.